I want those things cut down.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to the April work session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We have a very lengthy agenda this afternoon, and it's very clear to me on reflection that we will not be able to get through all of the items in the allotted time this afternoon. So what I would like to suggest is that we consider items 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 to be taken up tomorrow morning as we start the business session. Now, before I finalize the agenda, is there anyone who has traveled here to make one of those presentations and they cannot make it tomorrow morning? The last several items, beginning with item number 7. Is there any member of the board who will not be here tomorrow who needs to hear one of those presentations? Okay, and what I'll do is if things go a little bit faster than I expect they will, we can always try and do one or two of these things in advance of that.
That's a start.
Okay. If I may, we're going to start. Actually, the first four items are pretty quick, but with the emphasis on employment and job growth in our discussion today, which I hope will be very detailed on the Stimulus Act, we have four excellent presentations on four individual industrial access projects. And, you know, one of the great things about this program is it's directly tied to jobs. It's a wonderful program both for the highway industrial access and the rail industrial access program. So welcome, Mr. Page, for agenda item number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. It is to follow on with the chairman's comments. These four projects that I'm going to outline today as a briefing for the board will actually be taken up for action at next month's agenda for the action agenda of the meeting. These projects have been time in the making, and even in these economic hard times, it's very encouraging for me to come forward with you to you today to brief you on four very exciting projects to bring new job growth and industrial development in Virginia. As I stood before you at last month's meeting where the Department of Rail and Public Transportation was assisting in making transportation history in Virginia, I stand before you again with another item in the history of the Rail Industrial Access Sidetracks Program. We have never had two projects occur in the same jurisdiction at the same time. So Augusta County today, I'm going to go through two projects, as well as Northampton County, which is another fiscal distressed area of the Commonwealth. We have a project there, as well as in Bogota County as well, with unemployment higher than the state average. We have a project in that county as well. The first project that falls in Augusta County is the Midwest Vaco Corporation's new rendering distribution center, which will be located in Raphine in Augusta County. This is an adaptive reuse of an existing but vacant distribution center that Midwest Vaco is retrofitting. As this board may already know, Midwest Vaco has a very large paper rolling mill. They do bleached whiteboard and also activated charcoal in Covington. And also they compete very ambitiously globally with the outbound product from that mill and the other mills that they have, like at Luke, Maryland, and elsewhere in the country. This project entails the construction of 4,400 feet of track, supports a $33 million capital investment in Augusta County, and also creates 60 jobs in a locality that right now their unemployment rate, as you will see in your decision brief before you, is higher than that of the state average. This project also supports approximately 500 rail car shipments. It scored 63 points out of 100, which is fair, which is pretty good for the way we run our point system. And also, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this is on the 81 corridor. I want to point out to you all that this is also on the 81 corridor, Crescent Corridor line that Norfolk Southern has briefed us on, as well as with our Rail Enhancement Fund project advancements. And these carloads will help break trucks off of the highway system that is alongside and inside of the 81 corridor. This project has been supported by the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. And also, the allocation of the $450,000 for this project, which is $300,000 at no match and $150,000 matched dollar for dollar, will require a waiver from the Commonwealth Transportation Board's Rail Industrial Access Sidetracks Policies and Procedures, which very clearly states in Section 2E that any allocation of funds to a jurisdiction is capped at 300,000 unmatched funds and 150,000 matched funds dollar per year. So the $450,000, as I mentioned earlier, we have two projects in the same jurisdiction during these hard economic times. And this project, as well as the one following our agency through Director Badger, is recommending the board's consideration for this briefing today and also for action at next month's meeting to fund these projects. The Hershey Chocolate Company of Virginia is in Stewart's Draft, just not far north of Raphine. A lot of people don't know, but Hershey does manufacture chocolate products here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, as well as Little Debbie is right next door to McKee Foods. This project is supported by the Norfolk Southern Corporation as a serving rail line, as well as the one down in Raphine. The use of this sidetrack, which will be five new spurs, is a pretty large facility, as well as that with the 4,400 feet that we saw down at Raphine. We're noticing industries now, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, they're looking more for rail. Obviously, rail is becoming part of the logistics stream in how they're moving their transportation goods across the Commonwealth and in the nation as a whole. This project will bring in sugar products and other products for the manufacturing of chocolate and also Hershey's Reese's cups and other products that they manufacture. It's $6.4 million in local capital investment. Now, the last project was 60 jobs. This is 70 jobs. We'll also support more than 1,000 rail car shipments per year. Score just a little bit higher than Midwest Bay Coast because of the rail cars being a little bit higher. It's 66 points out of 100. And again, this project has been a cooperative effort of the Virginia Economic Development Partnership, Augusta County, and also DRPT coming forward with this recommendation. Again, as I mentioned earlier, this allocation of funds in next month's meeting will require the Commonwealth Transportation Board to waive its current policies and procedures of the 450 cap per jurisdiction per year. Again, we're recommending your consideration at next board's meeting. Obviously, we have a 30-day period here that the board can ask us any questions that they may have during that time. But we are, through Chip Badger, recommending that the $450,000 be awarded to this project. Our next project,
Mr. Chairman, is this an expansion of an existing plant, or this is a new facility just near the rail?
Yes, this is the second activity at Hershey. They built the plant over 25 years ago. We participated through the Commonwealth of Virginia through the rail access at that plant, as well as this will be our second project at this plant. Hershey continues to grow its business unit. As I mentioned earlier, it's right beside McKee Foods. Food consumable products seems to be a niche for Augusta County, and it continues to grow. So this, Ms. Connolly, is our second project up there over time.
Expansion.
Yes. Gerald Morin's son is over in Exmoor in Northampton County. For those of you who are familiar with Route 13, Gerald Morin's son is right adjacent to 13. And is also served by the Bay Coast Railroad. This project is to construct an 1,800-foot long adjacent track that will increase the throughput of our rail operations on the eastern shore to serve rock and aggregate to the shore itself. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, for those of you who might not be familiar with the eastern shore of Virginia, it's basically a sand non-aggregate source land matter and land material base. Due to the fact it is ocean sand bottoms, they don't have hard, heavy rock aggregate to use in highway construction and building material construction materials such as concrete, asphalt, and other aggregate uses on the eastern shore. This project has been long in the coming. We've been working with Gerald Moore for many years. We also, DRPT sits on the Accomack Northampton Transportation District Commission. And one of the challenges that Gerald Moore has had is that we've seen the railroad have to float rock across the Chesapeake Bay to actually serve Gerald Moore. And through a cooperative agreement and overhead usage of both Amtrak's Northeast Corridor and Norfolk Southern's Delmarva Eastern route down the eastern shore of Virginia, this project actually brings forward the ability to bring in unit trains of rock cars from the north and obviously help reduce the costs of aggregate to the consumers and citizens of the eastern shore. This project supports 500 rail car shipments per year. It too scored pretty good, 62 out of 100 points. The project was supported by the Accomack Northampton Transportation District Commission. And this project, it will require, and this is what we are requesting the board as well, is that the allocation of funds be acknowledged to the fact that this project has been in the making since 2005, and the necessary agreements with Norfolk Southern to bring the rock down, and also a rock provider in Pennsylvania, has been very helpful in making this project a reality. This project is a relatively low-cost funding project for the value that the Commonwealth, I feel, will get out of this by having the rock brought in and also the trucks brought off of Route 13. And this recommended funding is $131,800 at no match. Are there any questions, Mr. Chairman? Otherwise, I can move on to the next project. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the board, Lightsteel Technologies is located in Troutville in Botetourt County. This is our, by the way, Ms. Conley, for your information, this was an expansion project in Gerald Moore. The next project at Troutville is actually an adaptive reuse of a former pipe manufacturing facility. So today we have two project expansions and one adaptive reuse of a warehouse and one adaptive reuse of a steel manufacturing facility. Lightsteel Technologies in Troutville and Botetourt County is a project that has been in the making, as I will explain in just a minute to the board. This project is unique because Lightsteel Technologies is a new technology here that has been brought in from a European country. You can actually nail this steel and cut and drill this steel just like you can a 2x4 or any other type of wood dimensional beam. This is a $24 million project and the local capital investment. This project also brings forward 55 jobs to this area of Virginia, Botetourt County. Will support 500 rail car shipments per year. I scored 68, which was the highest score of the four projects. The project was supported by the Economic Development Partnership and Botetourt County Board of Supervisors, and also has been part of the Governor's Economic Development Initiative. Now, Mr. Chairman, if I can digress for just a minute, I do need to explain a timeline here, because this project is somewhat of a special exception of the board. During, as you'll take reference and throw your eyes to your decision brief if you'd like to have further reference on this, this project was qualified as eligible as an industrial access funding project back in August of 2006, following the Virginia Economic Development Partnerships and the Governor's Opportunity Fund, a cooperative agreement and proposal that was put forth to Lightsteel Incorporated. This project was also announced by Governor Kane back in November of 2006, and part of an agreement that was struck between the Virginia Economic Development Partnership, Botetourt County, and the Lightsteel, the industry being developed in the county. Botetourt County was to apply and secure the Rail Industrial Access Sidetracks application package and funding through the Commonwealth Transportation Board. As part of that same performance agreement, Botetourt County was to provide the $150,000 of equivalent match that would have been necessary to fund the project as presented in Governor Kane's package. Having said that, Botetourt County's administrative staff went into transition. The application was not submitted in a timely fashion. The company did fulfill its obligations to the Commonwealth that was set forth under the performance agreement, and the company contacted Botetourt County requesting their funding following the construction of the track here in March of 2009. I want to be very clear to this board that we have worked with the Office of the Attorney General on this project. We have had an extensive review of how this project has been applied for and represented. In no way can we find that the industry or the Commonwealth of Virginia has had anything to do with the project not coming forward in a timely manner, but unfortunately, due to Botetourt County's commitment and the transition of their staff, Botetourt County is requesting that the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth Transportation Board, give consideration to the situation that they're in, and through that recommendation that we're bringing forward, we're asking the board to give consideration to this project at its next meeting for action. Again, this project will be a waiver of the board acknowledging that the capital investment has occurred after the fact of the funding, before the fact of the funding, excuse me, and understanding that it was the due to the Botetourt County staff not being available or not able to apply for the grant funds before that position was vacated. So that is the explanation, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, on this project, and I'll go forward with the summary if there are any questions now, or I'll just go on forward with the summary of this presentation.
Mr. McCarthy.
If next month the board approves this $1.46 million, will there be any more money left in the fund for the rest of the fiscal year?
Yes, sir. There will be funding left in the remaining of the rest of the fiscal year. We've had a very light year. My guest is here somewhere. How are you doing on fund balance? Do you have one?
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCarthy, we are doing
quite well on fund balance, which means we're not doing so well on allocations this year. But we're this one, I don't see foresee having any impact on our ability to fund any new applications that come in for road access between now and the end of the fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman, do these, if we don't spend, what is it, $5 million or something?
It's $5.5 million. It's spread out over whether it's rail access, economic development, road access, or airport access.
And does that carry forward, or it gets lost?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCarthy, does carry forward.
It does. Yes, okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? So I guess the only clarification I would ask Mr. Page, you know, you talked about the Botetourt County. Essentially, there was a verbal agreement that was executed. It was never formalized in a written agreement. All of the investments, all of the jobs and the things that were expected that were done, there was a change in administration and the paperwork didn't follow. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, sir, that is a fair assessment.
Okay. Any other questions? I would hope...
Mr. Chairman, who's doing the matching on that then? I mean, is it Botetourt or...?
In this case, Botetourt County is providing the local match.
Oh.
And it was part of the incentive package that it was presented, as I explained, from back in 2006 to attract that industry to the Connex Pipe Plant location.
So this is, again, when the governor made this announcement with the county and the steel company, this was part of an overall incentive package to bring them here. So this is just bringing to closure those various strands of the incentives. I hope that if this is approved next month, is that correct, or is this on the agenda for today?
Next month, sir. Thank
next
you.
Month. That we do, by my count, there's about 205 jobs yep. associated with that investment. That's a great thing to have out there and to keep a good running tally of those investments and their value. Any other questions or comments? Okay, if not, then we're going to turn to the next item, which is a briefing on the location of the Western Outer Loop located in Culpeper County. Welcome, Mr. Utterback.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, let me see if I can...
See, there's a handout at everyone's place, a CTB decision brief with a couple of attached maps, and if you do a right click on that, you can get a rotate. There you go. He's getting proficient in his old age.
Well, he's not, but you are.
There are also at members' places at least two pieces of correspondence relating to this location decision. And both of them are copies from emails that have been received by the clerk to the board.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go through just a little bit of background. Again, you have a decision brief that covers the summary of the public hearing, which was conducted on September 11, 2008. Again, the purpose of this project is to construct a connector road that will join Route 729 on the north of Culpeper to Route 522 on the western side. This project is being funded. Does anyone have the brief?
It's in...
Sorry, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, we can't seem to locate those emails you referred to.
Yes, sir, ma'am. We don't have a day. Tell you what, let's go on to the next agenda item, if we may, while we're getting copies of this made. This we can't do this without the proper graphics. So if somebody could...
No, we have this.
We have this.
Correspondence.
Yeah, it's the correspondence.
The correspondence you referenced. You
know. Oh, the correspondence is what you're asking about?
Yes.
There are two emails that should have been on the top of your... very top of your file.
Bridgewater.
We have a bunch on Bridgewater.
Or I'm on Bridgewater.
Everything I've got is Bridgewater.
Oh, I'm sorry. The mistake is mine. Those... the Bridgewater is an action item on today's agenda. And that's what the correspondence relates to, not to the Culpeper.
Okay.
My mistake. Okay.
We're looking for a phantom.
has been duly corrected.
As you were.
That's all right. It should be one package with a decision brief, and then this map, and then a summary of the public hearing. Again, the purpose is to construct a connector road that will connect or join Route 29 to Route 522. This project is being funded through the revenue sharing program. And actually, to date, total allocations are $6,255,000. Probably a good point to break up. Again, this is a revenue sharing project. This is probably the third of a series of projects that Culpeper has committed to. They've built basically McDevitt Road, which goes from Route 3 north to Ira Hoffman, and then a piece from Ira Hoffman coming around the north side. So this is, again, making the connection from 729 down to 522. So again, both of those previous projects were funded through revenue sharing and developer, either donation and or building parts of the roadway. So it's probably a noteworthy, noteworthy that to note that the town, the county, the developers, and VDOT have worked together to try to get this loop around the town of Culpeper. To date, we've expended about just under $30,000 to do the public hearing. The county and town did ask VDOT to administer this project. One of the things going forward, again, is that the hearing was held in September. We had 43 people attend, and there was a 50-50 split. So this third project does match along with the other two projects that the county proposed in their comprehensive plan. So if you look at the map, just to summarize, there are two alternatives. There were three alternatives considered at the public hearing. One, of course, was a no build. The other two, alternative A and alternative B. So if you look at alternative A, which is annotated by the red line, basically that comes in, and on the map you can see the loop is going around a small body of water there, and it comes back into the town limit and ties into 522 there. There is a connection proposed on Yale Drive, which will take it by the elementary school. This alternative was about 2.2 miles long and I think had a little bit higher construction cost. The proposed construction was $9 million. And just another point, both of these alignments, the ultimate typical section would be four lane divided with 16-foot raised median and with both bike lanes and a sidewalk. So what they're proposing to build is the two-lane section of it. Okay, that's what's been done on the other two pieces as well. So initially it would be a two-lane construction on the four-lane alignment. If you look at alternative B, it goes a little bit farther west. And the significance of this is that it comes around and connects to 522, as again it ties into Jameson Road and then also goes out a little bit farther to the west. And this alignment would line up with the final piece, which would go from 522 south 29 and would give them the complete loop. And so through the public hearing, both the county and the town agreed with the alternative B alignment as the preferred alternative for this location.
Sorry, the B alignment, is that what you said?
Yeah. The B alignment, yes, sir.
Can I ask a quick question about that? I may be misreading this, but at what I guess is the western end of the B alignment, you see a street or lane called Pullum Lane. Does that connect into this new thing?
No, it doesn't. It goes around that. It would go around and tie in to a new intersection on 522 and then proposed location would go down to 641 Gibson Mill Road to continue south. So the idea is to try to line that up with the next piece.
Mr. Chairman, I may be able to help. Pullum Lane is a private road that serves two houses. It's private driveway.
No B&Bs though.
Okay, any other questions or comments? This will be an action item at next month's CTV meeting. Is there funding identified for this? So this is not a speculative project?
No, it is not a speculative. Mr. Chairman, the one of the drivers is right away, and there's a major landowner, and there is hopes that once we establish the location, we could approach and potentially work either donation or whatever. So right now, there are $6 million allocated in revenue sharing, and the total project cost is about $10 million. $3 million of that is roughly right away. So there is a potential to move rapidly on the project if we can get the developer or landowner to cooperate.
And are there resolutions from the town and the county?
We have letters from both of them after the public hearing supporting Alternative B.
And are those from the elected bodies?
Right. I'll verify that for sure.
That would be helpful to make sure that there's a formal resolution or some type of action, motion or resolution reflecting the will of both of those bodies would be helpful for next month.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Utterback?
Mr. Chairman, is this a limited access road?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Skeen, yes, this is proposed limited access.
Thank you, Mr. Utterback.
All right.
Okay, the next item on the agenda, actually 6A and 6B, and I hope folks will pay very close and detailed attention to this presentation. Action item 6A is a presentation and an update on the stimulus projects. What you will see in the presentation by Ms. Busher and Mr. Curley are two classes of projects. About half of the available funds are recommending for commitment and action tomorrow on the agenda. So this is a very important step forward. You may recall at last month's meeting, there was a briefing on pavements and bridges and a few other items as well. And the pavements and the bridges have advanced into procurement. This is building around that and includes, again, a quick overview of those pavements and bridges. So we're in the business of making some hard decisions. I would say today is relatively easy in that these project decisions are really kind of around statewide programs, and there's fairly defined and quantitative criteria in most cases and very immediate needs in the case of these projects. At our next meeting, and one of the things I'm going to ask is that we set up a date for an interim meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation, but we may need to do that to allocate the remainder of these stimulus funds. And I'm going to ask the Secretary of the Board if she would canvass the board and see if there's a time midway between now and the next session of the C2B. And we'll just see about availability. It will be important to have a very strong turnout for that meeting. Those are going to be the hard ones. And you may recall we had on the governor's website about $192 billion worth of project requests for $700 million worth of funds, even though you'll see this list has been winnowed down to a number of shovel-ready projects, and there are a couple of definitions of what shovel-ready is. You still face the disparity of several hundred million dollars of eligible projects and only a couple million, $100 million of available revenues. The next meeting on this topic, I think, will be a little more challenging than this one. With that, Ms. Busher, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, just a couple of highlight slides. Nationwide, what we are calling the stimulus program, or ARA, $47.9 billion was proposed for various programs, the discretionary grant program of $1.5 billion, aviation dollars of $1.3 billion, rail $9.3 billion, public transportation $8.4 billion, and then highways, which we'll focus on today, of $27.5 billion nationwide. Just to touch briefly on the rail program of $9.3 billion, $8 billion of that has been identified for high-speed rail corridor program, and funding will be available until September of 2012. This slide that I captured from a previous presentation indicated that the Federal Railroad Administration would develop a strategic plan by mid-April. I believe the and the Secretary will have to correct me, that either comes out today or tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
So we'll find out what that is all about. And by mid-June, USDOT will issue the interim guidance for applicants. There's also $1.3 billion that's set aside for Amtrak capital grants. On public transportation, there was $8.4 billion nationwide. $6.9 billion, again, is available through September 30, 2010. And that's broken down by $5.5 billion for urbanized area formula grants directly to the operators, $700 million for rural area formula, which passes through DRPT, $700 million for growing states and high-density programs, funds allocated to states based on formula. 50% must be obligated within 180 days, and the portion not obligated is, as you know, possibly redistributed to other transit agencies or states. And the remaining 50% must be obligated within 1 year. Somewhat similar terms to the highway funding. There's also $750 million in rail modernization grants distributed by formula, and the last $750 million in rail new starts and small start grants.
If I might just stop right there, and you're going to have a second presentation by DRPT, but understand, and if you had an opportunity to read the letter that I sent to the relevant committees of jurisdiction on this, in different modes, the decisions are made by different entities. So in the case of most of the rail projects, that's going to be done by the Federal Railroad Administration or by USDOT. In the case of public transportation, the bulk of that, about 95%, will be made by the individual transit operators. Actually, it's a little bit less than that. But for the large transit operators, what you will see, so for example, is about $110 million that comes back to Virginia. And that goes to Metro, to VRE, to Hampton Roads Transit, to Greater Richmond Transit. And then the next item on the agenda will be for the small urban and the rural and DRPT, and those decisions are made by this body. So you'll have some transit decisions to make here, but just for the rural and small urban transit. Okay? Sorry to interrupt.
Now, back to highways, the $27.5 billion that was appropriated nationwide. Virginia, as you know, will receive $694.5 million. We must obligate 50%, at least 50%, of the discretionary funds within 120 days, and the clock started ticking March 2nd. And successful states may receive bonus distribution from those states or programs that have not fully obligated federal funds within that 120-day time frame. Now, our progress to date along this process, we have received the federal criteria for the stimulus funding, and we have received guidance and reporting forms. So we actually have submitted two reports to date, and we'll submit a third one next week. We have also consulted with the congressional delegation, with members of the General Assembly. We have also communicated a couple of times with the MPOs and are in the process of sending TIF amendments for our selected projects to the MPOs. And we've been in consultation with localities and various advocacy groups.
The Chair would also observe this process indicates that federalism is alive and well in America. If you look at that, there are four different layers of government involved in this process, and it has been a challenge.
Our next steps, starting with today, would be the CTB project review of the projects Mal Curley will show you in a few minutes, and your approval. We will be doing a stimulus amendment to the fiscal year 2009 through 14 six-year improvement program and amend the 2009 VDOT budget amendment, or budget, which will be tomorrow. As I said, we are pursuing TIP amendments to the MPOs as necessary on chosen projects. And once we have those TIP amendments, the governor will then be able to certify the project list to the U.S. DOT. And from that, we can then obligate and start drawing down the funding from FHWA. And you will actually see some of these projects come back to you for award, those that are $2 million in value or higher. I will now turn it over to the chief engineer.
I appreciate the need to get going on this, and glad to see that we're ready and hope we get bonus money too, but when would these come back for approval, like June, July, September?
I think Mr. Curley will be able to answer that.
I'll answer that question.
No, I thought you were going to say we were going to deal with that later. But
To answer your question, sir, we have put on the street right now some pavement projects, about $110 million. We're going to leave them out for 3 weeks, come back the 29th of this month. We plan to bring those back, the ones that need to come to the board greater than $2 million, May for you to award. The bridge projects that we put out, we're putting those out 3 months. I believe that's in July, so they'll probably come August to the board for approval for those.
And again, in the interest of time, we may need to schedule an August meeting of the CTB in order to keep these aggressive timelines.
As Reed has indicated, as the Secretary indicated, we are seeking some approvals, and wherever you see on the slides where it says VDOT recommendations, those are the ones that Rita mentioned tomorrow. She'll have a resolution to come that we're going to move forward. The first group here is the mandatory enhancement projects. I understand Mike Estes has worked with members of the board. You should be familiar with the small number. The timeline that we have requires a small number of projects, and here shows the list of the projects that we are going to be advancing under the mandatory enhancement projects. The second group here that we're recommending forward is about $96 million for BRAC-related projects. There is about $11 million project in the Richmond District at Fort Lee, the Fairfax County Parkway, phases 3 and 4, about $60 million combined for those, and the Fort Eustis widening down Hampton Roads, about $24.5 million. There's a couple other Quantico and the Defense Intelligence Agency that are still under review, and we're not at this time seeking recommendation to move those forward. The next group has to do with the 7 design-build contracts that we have or put out on the street. We worked very closely with the Federal Highway Administration was able to get these projects forward. It's 119 small structurally deficient or soon-to-be structurally deficient bridges. I believe there's actually 111 of them are structurally deficient. 4 of them are functionally obsolete, and 2 of them will probably be deficient next year. And since they're in the vicinity of other ones, it was cost-effective and it met the criteria. Basically, most of them are general condition 4 or less, are functionally obsolete. No right-of-way requirements, environmental documentation have been completed. We estimate the value of that about $66 million. This shows us breakdown by districts of the 7 different ones. When I say bridge, it's bridges and culverts. There are culverts in here, smaller bridges and culverts. The other category we have are structurally deficient paving projects. It's about 430 lane miles of interstate and primary paving contracts or overlays. Basically, the pavement index was in a poor, very poor condition, less than 53 for most of the segments. I think there was one from the district viewpoint working with the district administrator, the recommendation because of the structure itself of the pavement structure need to be replaced. No right-of-way requirements on here, and the environmental documentation has been complete, estimated about $110 million on those. This shows the breakdown through the districts, and these were from recommendations from all the district administrators, mainly concentrated on the interstate system and the primary system. Two design build construction projects we are recommending to move forward at this time is Route 3 in Spotsylvania. It's a design build contract that was ready to go. We were almost, we had to stop the procurement of this because of the funding situation. It's one that we can move very quickly. And then the design build contract for the second rail on the I-164 rail down in Portsmouth. There's intergovernment agreements between us and Spotsylvania County, us and the port, and all the environmental documents and right-of-way are complete on these projects. That's about $32 million. Here, you see at the top of the list, it says possible. These are ones we will not ask you tomorrow to move forward. These are things that we are looking at. Staff is moving forward. I've directed staff to ensure that we could have these available. And we're moving forward in the all these projects shown here and on your next sheet, these projects. But at this time, we're not asking for your approval for these particular projects. I am also asking for approval. Rita, these will be approved tomorrow. For additional paving projects. And the reason I'm going to do that is because we've set aside about $110 million.
This is slide 17.
Yes. Slide 17. We will ask to move these particular projects forward so we can work with the necessary MPOs and the federal government to have these available. And the reason I'm asking for these is that we have put $110 million on the street. I'm estimating, top of the head guess, maybe, hopefully the bids are going to come in somewhere around $80 million. And we're basing that on our recent projects in the paving area that have been very competitive that we have. So we want to have some in reserve that should the bids come in, when they come in on the 29th, then I can put some more out to cover the funding that we have. What we plan to do, similar to what we did with the paving projects that are out now, about May 7th or 8th next month, should our bids that come in on the 29th of April be lower than $110 million, that we will be advancing these projects forward and then take these in at the end of May so the board could award those in June. So basically it's something in the back pocket to ensure that we're meeting the targets that we're going to have. The other thing important to get projects out on the street, obviously, so we can bid them, and there may be excess funds available that then we can then identify another project under stimulus and move that forward. And Rita and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, under the vicious pavement projects, are those primarily interstate or primary?
Those were primary interstate, primary in your particular area, sir. I talked with Garrett on that, and your pavement's in pretty good condition as we were looking from a statewide viewpoint, and what's recommended for your area is what Garrett recommended to me.
Okay. The other part, Mr. Chairman, is the bridge work. I noticed the same pattern on bridge work, and I know there are a long list of deficient bridges in the Stanton District, and yet there appeared to be a very small amount. I'm just curious there.
Ken Wallace, the state structure and bridge engineer, has been working with all the nine district bridge engineers to identify. When we started putting this project together, the goal was to eliminate as many structurally deficient bridges as we possibly could. We did not know what the timeline for the funding would be. We were trying to identify the projects that had little environmental work, no right-of-way work, no substructure work, and it basically came down to low-volume type roads. They established a criteria, and what came out is what the recommendation from the district bridge engineers in each of the nine districts did.
If I could add, and I think that's a very legitimate question. I spent about 2 hours answering that very question by a couple of delegates from your district as well. One of the things that has happened here, and I think has tremendous application going forward, is our program shrinks so dramatically. What the department did was to take major segments of pavement and rank it on a score of 1 to 100. And that's not a subjective. There's a truck that rides over it and takes the readings, and they do occasional course. And the same thing with bridges. There's a numeric rating. And so, you know, you've got a list from 1 to 10, but then there are intervening criteria. For example, is the environmental documentation complete? Can it be constructed within the timelines laid down? So those things tend to sift things out. But I think this is the way, as we look forward, and when we get done with the next presentation, I'd like to talk a little bit going forward about the update of the six-year program. There's no such thing, honestly, as a district or a local allocation anymore. We have very scarce statewide resources, and so we have to develop needs-based criteria for allocating this, and I think what VDOT has come up with is very, very impressive and very defensible, I might add, in presentation to the General Assembly and to the congressional delegation as well. I would say, too, with respect to the question about bridges, and I've asked many of those same questions, and there's kind of a simple answer. You got wider rivers up in the northwestern part of the state and down in the southeastern part. There are very few bridges, for example, in the Hampton Roads area because the bodies of water are so large, they involve extensive environmental documentation and permitting, and they're very expensive. So in your, I guess it's the Route 340 bridge, there are two Route 340 bridges that are structurally deficient. Those are in the early stages of design and environmental permitting and also very expensive.
The reason I asked the second question, I mean, I trust the staff to be honest with you about pavement quality, and I think we are fortunate in many ways with the pavement quality. But I don't agree with the assessment on the bridges because just a short time ago, I was looking at and Stanton District ranked either first or second with the number of deficient bridges, and I was also under the impression that there was a significant number of projects that were going to be addressed in the Stanton District for bridges, even though some of our allocations were much lower in a lot of other areas. But to see all of it go down to this level doesn't seem logical to me as I look at the situation, even hearing your explanation. And I don't have a great deal of argument about the idea of using formulas and reasoned approach that has nothing to do with the district, because I think it makes good sense. But when logic doesn't fit about the number of bridges and the quality of those bridges, then I have to ask the question, are you sure?
I'll be happy to share the criteria and just go over some numbers. The breakdown, there were out of the 119 bridges, 21 of them are in the Stanton District. 18 bridges and 3 culverts are in the Stanton District.
For $2 million?
It's for... If you go back up to the third one, there's Culpeper, Northern Virginia, and Stanton, 10.6.
I'm sorry.
All right, so there's some bridges. I think the $2 million one is a category where the culverts are located
okay,
in there.
Thank you. All right.
And I'll be happy to share, Mr. Chairman, the criteria that the bridge people went through.
That's different.
In it.
Thank you.
And,
never mind.
And I'll be happy to share that with the board.
That makes much sense.
Yeah.
Ms. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I have the same question, Dr. Davis, about why North Virginia wasn't there, and it's because all our projects actually cost a lot more.
Yeah, I sent you some information on that, too.
So they're not in this particular design-build approach.
Right.
I have a question.
And we would also comment, Mr. Kuhlman, that the Northern Virginia District loves its conversations through its various regulatory processes. And, in fact, you'll see on this next list a couple of bridges that, when I first started in Prince William County, were regional priorities. And as Ms. Connolly can attest, they've been a subject of a lot of spirited conversation through the administrative permitting process.
We love to debate in Northern Virginia. It's our national pastime. I have a question, Mal. In terms of the possible additional Recovery Act projects, is there a set of criteria that governs those as well that's separate from our normal allocations, or is this really a question, because these are larger projects, of finding the right mix of ones that can go forward that already have money in them that really are ready to go? And in other words, if you were to add
up the cost of everything on this page and this page, I would have to go and ask Rita for some more money. So you have to understand also, as we're developing these projects, some are going to fall off for, you know, we're going to run into here. So we're trying to do more than our number, and then we're working with the Secretary's Office and Commissioner to determine exactly which projects, working with the board, that we are going to move forward. But, for instance, in the Stanton District, I've directed staff to move two of the Stanton projects forward, and actually we're moving all these projects forward. I would like to hone in on three or four of them, just concentrate on those, but we need to have flexibility. And if we don't use some of these projects from a stimulus viewpoint, then we have a regular program, because a lot of these projects are in our regular program, and we will have those available when we do our normal federal authorization. So Rita's trying to balance the stimulus and our normal and see what the right mix is.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious, was Port Republic one of the ones you were trying to address?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
You can see that on the list.
Only other question that I had, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen on any of the lists for some reason either the other fork of the Shenandoah River going into Front Royal. Is that not on the list, the second bridge? The first one's under construction, near finished. But
I don't believe it's. I will check. I don't believe it's on the list. But
it's a 60 million. Maybe it's too big. It's a $60 million project.
You have to remember, we're trying to keep the stimulus money and our normal program, even though they're intertwined, we still have our normal program to deliver. So if it's in our normal program with an ad schedule and everything, we're still working on that. We're looking at some of these that we could use stimulus money on, some we can bring forward, and those various things. But we're still working on our normal program on top of whatever the stimulus projects we have.
I was just wondering, when you talked about consultation with the MPOs, most of these projects are either already certified in the STIP and the TIP, and some of them are not even eligible for that review. Is this, or to what extent does the what was the MPO involvement in this?
We are in fact looking for some TIP amendments. Some of these project earlier phases may be in the TIP, but maybe not the construction phase, which is where we're applying the stimulus dollars, so we would need to amend the TIP for that. The pavement and bridge projects are done as a group in the TIPs, mm-hmm. in the different MPOs across the state. So we have to increase the value of that grouping for bridge projects and pavement projects to accommodate the increased level of funding that we're using, that we're adding with the stimulus dollars. So it depends on whether the project has been in the program before and we're funding a phase, or whether it's a new project and we're looking to fund the whole thing. So we're just taking it one project at a time in terms of amending or updating the TIP.
Do you anticipate that will be a delay of any significance?
We've already started. We had a video conference with all the MPOs. We have, in fact, gotten our first TIP amendment today from Northern Virginia on the bridges and the pavements. That was the first thing we had come forward with, so we already submitted those, and the MPOs are looking at those. They have agreed, because of the 120-day timeline that we have for the first 50%, that they're advancing those TIP amendments to accommodate that time frame for us, as well as some of them are working on their own project lists, as you know.
I'm aware of that. Could I one over the Quantico and the DIA?
Right, before you leave that, just glancing down this list, I think with one possible exception, every project, and maybe even not that, every project has even been canceled or delayed previously, so it's been a part of a TIP previously, and then we canceled funding, so it's a question, canceled or delayed the project, so it's a question of restoring it. So it's been, you know, to be shovel ready, you have to have been through an awful lot to get there. The
right.
Second thing, as Ms. Buescher reminded you, is the MPOs, the five MPOs in state, have money that is dedicated to them and that they are attempting to allocate on projects. And so some things that might be a priority for us, we're doing, they have to adjust their plans and vice versa. It's a delicate dance and conversation, and it's compounded by the fact that for example, the Northern Virginia, the TPB meets exactly the same time as the CTB does. So A coordination has been somewhat challenging on those fronts. Some of the projects that may be priorities of the localities, the constituent localities of the MPOs, may not be eligible. So we have a process, and the governor has designed for all projects. So there will be...
So this is complex, as yes, I thought it
and
might be.
And potentially contentious.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, because time is of the essence. Good.
Mr. White.
I'm sorry, Ms. Connelly, did you have a follow-up question?
I just wanted to ask about the Quantico and the DI, the Defense DIA. That is, we will be hearing more about that.
Yes, the BRAC projects that we're recommending to move forward are ones that we can move forward right away. We're still looking and reviewing those other projects, and we would bring them back to the board for approval to move forward. So we're moving the ones in there. I plan right after this to work to advertise them and to get that money obligated. And we're going to go down, and then as we get the MPO and the governor's approval, we're going to be ready to put these on the street. And those are ones that weren't at that level as the other three.
Yeah, but they're really needed, right. Too.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. White.
All right. Now, help me talk a little bit about the process by which the smaller MPO's input is being handled. I know that the staff has advised those MPO's to get in touch with members of the board, because I've been hearing from some smaller MPO's. How are those projects being filtered through your office? And how do they fit into this list of possible additional projects? I mean, I assume this list is not exclusive. There are going to be additions to it and subtractions from it. But particularly with regard to, I think it's $90 million that's allocated to the smaller MPOs. How's that being handled?
Because of the not having the requirements until late when we started looking at projects, and we have the option through the STP formula, which is by population, to pick those projects ourselves for the sake of time. What we are doing is, once those are approved, we do still have to pick projects that are in the population areas driven by that formula. So we're looking at projects. Part of that $90 million is for localities with population less than 200,000 but more than 5,000, and then 14 million of that 90 million is for projects in localities with less than 5,000 population. So we're looking at those, we're looking at distressed areas, and we're looking at spreading them across the state. But we will submit those for TIF amendments to the MPOs as necessary. So we would have conversations at that time. We just haven't gotten to that point yet.
Ms. Chairman, do you have a timeline as to when that might be occurring?
I'd say within the next 30 days.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome the Hampton Roads and Fredericksburg regions. Gentlemen, too late. There was a massive rearrangement of the stimulus fund.
In other directions, I think.
Let me go around. This is very important, and I want to make sure. Peter, do you have any questions, concerns, or comments?
No, I'm good.
And I'd like to give a chance to Mr. Dickens and Mr. Sterling to look at the list. Because there's going to be a vote tomorrow on the list of projects, and if you look at your presentation piece, the portion that says VDOT recommendations, there are about four or five pages. Those are the ones that we'll be asking your vote on, and if you could take a quick look at those and see if you have any questions, beginning with the enhancement projects. Ms. King.
I might ask a question on the possible additional pavement projects. Is this list prioritized that we have here in terms of possible projects?
Are they prioritized? You mean we're going to go from the top, bottom?
Yeah.
No. They're just shown on there. As you know, we probably got a list that started with Bristol at the top and came on down. So it's not prioritize, and we plan to move all these forward depending on what our bids come in and what monies that we've have left in that category.
We would apply the needs-based model to these.
Yeah, in these particular ones right here, the needs-based model was applied to get on the list. I'm anticipating that on all these, with the exception of maybe a couple, we will advance these forward after we get bids in, depending on what our bids from the first round are. Based on our previous bids that recently came in, I've asked the secretary if it comes in at 116.7, is that going to be okay? And he said he would work with me on that. So we're trying to make sure that we at least $110 million in paper.
Ms. Davies, do you have any questions or concerns? Mr. Billy?
No.
Mr. Martin?
Already been addressed.
Okay. Mr. Dickens or Mr. Sterling, any questions or comments?
Wow. Well, a lot of comments. Thank you. I mean, there are some things in here that definitely needed to move forward given the cuts that we had to make last year and under design build in particular. And Ms. Carter wanted me to reiterate this on the Route 3 project, which was so close to going to contract and had to get pulled back at the last minute. Inclusion of that under design build is critical for that particular route. So on behalf of her as well as everybody in the Fredericksburg region, thanks.
Just a quick question for the chief engineer. Even for those projects valued under $2 million, which we will administratively sign off on, I'm assuming you'll still provide a monthly update to the board of those projects.
Yes, we will report back to the board what we've awarded and be happy to report back what the bid prices were on that so we can see. I'm hoping that we'll free up a little bit of money maybe to go to another project. Yes, sir. But by code, you have the authority to sign those contracts or authorize them.
It'll be the rare stimulus project, though, that is less than $2 million. I think there's a small handful of enhancement projects to date that fall below that amount.
Mr. Chairman, just on the possible additional Recovery Act highway and rail projects, what's the gross amount? I mean, I know all this is a moving target, but how much is probably available for them?
What's available for that? If you take what I'm asking you to approve and go through the ones that we're saying recommend, that's about $328 million right there. We have to, as Rita has said, by June 30th, obligate 243, 244. And so we have more right now than we have to obligate by that time. And so we would have how much left, Rita, from about $160 million? Or?
Yeah, about $160.
That has not been obligated.
Okay.
And if you were to go down this list, I'm sure that this list will cost in the neighborhood of at least $400.
There's a B in there, 162. I think there's a B in there.
Yeah. We're up, $300, $400, $500 million if we added all these up. Yeah.
Okay, well, if there are no additional questions or comments, and just understand tomorrow you'll be asked to vote on those specific recommendations. Now, the next presentation, DRPT and Mr. Hill will be presenting. These are, again, this is the first wave of the rural and small urban transit, and you'll be asked to vote on these tomorrow. What's different about these projects is that these allocations are in response to a grant request from a small urban or rural transit provider. Welcome, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. The Secretary and Rita have described things well, so I'll be brief. As Rita had mentioned, the Recovery Act has $8.4 billion in it for public transportation. The bulk of it goes through FTA formula programs. So formula funds are coming out of the Recovery Act. And basically how those funds come to Virginia specifically is the Secretary had mentioned In the urban areas, the transit properties in those areas are direct recipients. Those funds don't flow through DRPT. They go directly to Metro, VRE, PRTC in Prince William County, Richmond, and Hampton Roads. What comes through DRPT is the money for rural and small urban systems. That amount is $30.5 million. As the Secretary mentioned, it's the Board's decision on the allocation of those funds. In terms of the $30.5 million, it breaks out about $18.6 million of it for rural, $11.9 million of it for small urban. Our recommendations to you, as the Secretary had mentioned, come out of our typical annual grant application process, which concluded on February 1st, as it always does. We had more applications, though, this year from small urban properties than for rural. And as a result, what we're going to be recommending to you for approval tomorrow is $17.3 million out of that $30.5 be allocated for rural and small urban transit programs. The remaining balance of the $30.5 million, we'd like to do a second round of applications, kind of an off-cycle application period this summer, which will enable us to obligate the remaining funds within the one-year time frame that we're required to do that by. Getting to the initial allocation, the $17.3 million, I know this chart's a little hard to read. The way it basically breaks out for the rural systems, we've got $3.8 million worth of recommendations. You'll notice that by far, basically what we're doing here is replacing old equipment. So a lot of old buses need to be replaced. This is the perfect opportunity to do that. These buses have reached their useful life. Buying new buses will lower the maintenance costs for the systems, will provide more reliable buses on the street, better service for the patrons, so it's certainly an appropriate an expenditure and something that we support. On the small urban systems, same thing, $13.5 million worth of recommended allocations, largely replacement buses, and then miscellaneous equipment, which is everything from spare parts, engine assemblies, shop equipment, the things that our transit systems need every day to keep the systems running at their optimum speed and pace. So for the allocation, one of the key questions that's come up that we've been talking about with our grantees is, because we've had more applications this initial round from the small urban folks, what we actually need to do to meet that 50% obligation is we're going to shift $6 million from the rural program to the small urban program to meet those obligations in the Recovery Act. However, though, we recognize that it's important for us through that second round of applications that we'd like to do this summer to work very closely with the rural folks so that we balance it back out and get them closer to that $18.5 million allocation that was originally received. So we think we're confident we're going to be able to do that. We've been in close contact with the rural providers, and we shouldn't have a problem achieving that. So just to wrap up our next steps, you do have an action item tomorrow for allocating $17.3 million, which is approximately 57% of that $30.5 million. We need to obligate at least 50% of it to meet the requirements of the Recovery Act. From there, we will coordinate with the transit operators, the MPOs, and the FDA to get those funds obligated. There are, as the Secretary mentioned, lots of processes to go through to make that happen, but we're ready to do that. We'll do the secondary round of applications in the summer, and then we'll be back to you with another recommendation for the final $13.2 million in the fall so that we can again meet that final requirement to obligate the full $30 million within 1 year of the Act. Are you happy to answer any questions?
Questions, Mr. Hill?
Mr. Chairman, with the borrowing from the rural fund, is that sort of a moral obligation that you feel to put it back, or is that a real obligation that you're going to work with them to be sure that they activate the process of requesting and working with you? Because I know they're slow.
It is more of a moral obligation, but we part of the issue that came up for a lot of properties this year is that our application cycle really begins in December. And in December, when people were putting together their applications and talking to local governments about, do we have any match money for the upcoming fiscal year? The economic times were very tough, and I think people were saying this isn't the year to really go in and ask for a bunch of things because of the local match situation.
But this doesn't require a match.
Well, the applications were due, though, February 1st. The Act was passed February 17th. And so for a lot of the rural systems, I think if they had had a better sense that they might be able to get 100% funding, they would have come in with more projects. And that's exactly what the conversations have been. So we've been talking to them over the past month to get them ready and make sure they're aware that there will be a second round and that we'll need their timely applications to get them the funding they need.
I had at least one contacted me and indicating they just didn't feel they had time to get it in, but they definitely want an opportunity. And I just want to be sure that in that second round, that if they do what they're supposed to do, that they do have an opportunity to have access to these funds.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what we want to have happen here.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Hill? Mr. Badger, do you have any closing comments?
No, I think Mr. Hill described it very well.
Okay. Thank you very much. This has gone extremely well. Mr. Hill, just one quick question. What percentage of your overall small urban and rural transit are you asking the board to commit tomorrow?
It's approximately 57% of the $30.5 million.
So there's roughly 40% left over for these other rural and small
transit. We actually worked very hard to get it just over 50% so we could maximize the amount available for that second round. That was a conscious effort.
And am I mistaken? Is that not a requirement? Don't you have a 180-day obligation window?
That's correct. We have to obligate a minimum of 50%, and so we were shooting as close to that target as possible.
Thank you very much.
One sort of clarification. I know with the transit, we've been very concerned about their operating costs and the fact that these are capital improvements only, but some of them may have a domino effect in actually making the transit companies a little more efficient because of the newer vehicles, or am I just sort of hopefully?
No, you're exactly right. There is an indirect benefit to it being 100% capital money, in that for those that were going to spend, you know, that normally would have to spend local money mm-hmm. on other capital projects because this doesn't cover every single capital need they have.
Mm-hmm.
There are other capital needs that do require local money. This is going to free up some local money that they can put to operating, which is going to help them there, and then it'll also, as you say, will buy them more efficient vehicles, which will reduce their maintenance costs. So there's definitely some benefits here for them.
Great.
In that respect.
What would, Mr. Hill, what would the normal capital match requirement be for one of these jurisdictions?
Well, it depends. Our capital program varies from year to year, but in this time frame, the stimulus money is
100%, so no match required. If they were buying the exact same equipment, what would their match requirement would be?
Closer to 25% to 30%.
Mm.
Okay. Great program. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like we're making very good headway on our agenda, so we're going to keep plowing through here. Our next presenter is Mr. Hill, who's going to be talking about the state of the commute survey and key findings, along with assisted by Dan Rudge. And this is an important undertaking. The data here is a little bit old, I think it's fair to say, but a very important snapshot in time and the first time that DRPT has undertaken this exercise on a statewide basis. They have participated in regional exercises in the D.C. metro area and Hampton Roads previously, but this is the first statewide look at this. And something you'll be doing, what, every 3 years? Is
this right? Okay, so members of the board, as the Secretary mentioned, I'm going to talk now about our Virginia State of the Commute Survey. This is probably the most comprehensive research and evaluation project we've ever done, and it is tremendously robust. I won't have time to get into all the details today, so what we've done is we just kind of boiled it down to the five key findings for you, but there's a lot more information available than what I've got time to present to you today. So if you've got additional interest, we'd be happy to give you some more information. The State of the Commute Survey, we actually did it in 2007. In 2008, we finished all of the analysis on it and wrapped it up, and we've been using the information. So it's been out there. We've been using it. We've just had a hard time with so many things going on bringing you the information here today. But basically, the survey is approximately of 7,000 employed residents in the Commonwealth of Virginia. The purpose of the survey was twofold. We wanted to document trends in commuting behavior, and we wanted to collect some attitudinal data on where people are with respect to their commutes. This actually is an expansion, though, of a survey that's been done, as the Northern Virginia CTV members I'm sure are aware, of the MWCOG State of the Commute Survey. Essentially, what we've done is leveraged that survey and done it for the entire state. is basically what we've done here. The objectives, fourfold here. One is to develop a profile of the mode split for Virginia. What modes are people using to commute to work? We want to understand the difference between market areas. Certainly Northern Virginia is going to have one approach to commuting, and other areas of the state may be completely different, so we want to understand that. Assess the awareness and the role of the transportation choices that you all are funding. And are people aware of them? Are they working? What's the feeling out there? And then also, what's the support for more investment in the transportation choices? So with that, let's get to the first key finding, which is when it comes to work trips, Virginians are, in fact, embracing those transportation choices that we're putting out there. We know that because of this slide here, which tells us that we do have a significant mode split for our other transportation choices versus just driving alone. And in Northern Virginia, it's especially prominent, as we see there's a 30% mode share. And even in specific corridors within Northern Virginia, that mode split can get as high as 50 to 60% of other transportation choices versus driving alone. So those options are really being taken advantage of in Northern Virginia as well as in the rest of the state. We know that the transportation choices that we're putting out there are also very effective in getting people that are driving alone out of their cars. Here we see that 46% of people that are using one of the other transportation choices were driving alone before they came to rail or bus. So we've been successful in pulling them out of those cars. Just one more fact to support it, that one out of three started using their current mode in the past 12 months or less. Now the Secretary mentioned this is a 2007 survey. So the data is a little old, but at the same time we actually benefit from the fact, because if this was done in 2008 when gas prices were so high, this might not be so relevant. But now that gas prices have dropped back down again, you can see that even before gas prices were spiking, people were migrating to these other transportation choices. Key finding number two, infrastructure and outreach are keys to making these transportation choices work. Here we see that just on the issue of HOV systems, the infrastructure there is incredibly important, where we see that folks that live in the Fredericksburg region and in the Northern Virginia region, where they've got a pretty robust HOV system, they're really taking advantage of that system. In Hampton Roads, the connections between the HOV systems are not as strong, and so therefore we see not nearly the kind of usage that we'd like to see.
Excuse me, Corey, go back to that slide a minute. What does that percentage represent again, like the 68, for example? 68% of what?
The questions are listed at the bottom from the survey, so the question that's being asked here is, did the HOV lane influence your decision?
So is this a question that was asked just of HOV lane users?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the survey is a very complex tool, and that it's very lengthy, and we get to a point where if you're this kind of user, we ask you this series of questions. If you're a train user, we ask you.
Okay, so this was asked of the HOV users.
Yes.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, I don't. You know, I'm looking at the question. Did the HOV lane influence your decision? And if this is being asked of HOV users,
so if you're a carpooler,
what were the 20 other 32% thinking? They're HOV users, but the HOV lane didn't influence their decision.
For some of them, the issue for carpooling and van pooling may be about saving money. It may be about companionship. It may be about less stress. Maybe some of those other issues, in addition to just the fact that there's an HOV lane.
Oh, okay.
Not everybody carpools and van pools just because of the presence of an HOV lane.
So this question wasn't asked just of HOV lane users. It was asked of everybody who was anything other than a single occupancy car commuter. Okay, now I get it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Same thing for parking.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Corey, on the Fredericksburg, that's a very robust number. Do you know where they went?
It's that 95 corridor. We have an incredible...
Well, I mean, did they disperse at the Beltway, or do you know how many...
A lot of it is continuing downtown to the district and to the Pentagon. we've got such a robust group of van poolers. Mm-hmm. We've got over 500 van poolers in that corridor, which is, and that is really what part of what makes that HOV lane there one of the most successful in the country. But most of it is,
and most of the van pools don't go, say, west on the Beltway because there are not that many locations where they have that, but they go to the federal city.
They do, and the Titan, you know, Tyson's Corner is the major employment center, and that's the draw. But of course, the problem there is you get to the Beltway and you're stopped. Now, an interesting point though is with the Hot Lanes project, suddenly that's going to open up new connections for the HOV network in new markets. So transit and carpool and vanpool, I think you'll see a pretty significant spike in usage once that market gets opened up.
Some models predict more than pretty significant. You know, the other thing to keep in mind, again, in this Fredericksburg and Northern Virginia, you have 90,000 direct DOD jobs at Quantico, at Engineer Proving Grounds, at Belvoir, at the Mark Center, and the Pentagon. And their parking and personnel and flex time policies are extremely conducive. They are the region that HOV exists and flourishes, along with the federal employees in the Federal Triangle. You take that away, there is not the demand or the support of transportation policies for that.
So that HOV network and structure is really important. Also, which goes hand in hand with it, is the infrastructure of park and ride lots. Park and ride lots make a really interesting difference here. Where there are no park and ride lots, we see a drive-alone rate of 89%. But where there are park and ride lots, we see that you're going to have a drive-alone rate that basically drops significantly. You get almost a 9-point lift from when you've got the presence of park and ride lots. So park and ride lots are really paying off significantly in terms of getting people to carpool and vanpool and also use the bus. So that's the infrastructure piece of it. The outreach piece of it, where we've found that we were really successful with our outreach programs, is that for the respondents to the survey, over 74% of them can cite as the benefit of ride sharing and transit, saving money, saving gas. That's a very powerful message that we can tell has really gotten through to these folks. They understand it, they can cite it, they've heard the messages, they can repeat the messages. So that marketing, that outreach is working very well. Interestingly enough, now again, this is 2007, but the environmental concern is not quite as important. You hear so much about Go Green and everyone's putting so many dollars into Go Green advertisements, but the thing that's really sticking in people's heads is saving money and saving gas.
Mr. Chairman, just, you know, it's really interesting statistic that Curry just cited, because it shows the huge elasticity of demand based on gas price, and it leads to a really interesting conversation about how a substantially increased gas tax or a mileage tax, while at the same time raising money for infrastructure dollars, also has the potential of substantially shifting consumer demand away from roads and onto the mass transit. I mean, there's potentially a huge double benefit there, which I think a lot of us always suspected was there, but it's interesting to see how dramatic that statistic is.
Well, and again, the Hot Lanes project, that's pricing, and real-time pricing, which actually has a stronger feedback loop than even a gas tech, and that's one of the theories behind the 95 and the Beltway Hot Lanes. As we start looking at major pricing projects in the Hampton Roads, that issue will also be before us there.
Mr. Chairman, this fits, though, directly with the research we got earlier from VDOT's own research unit, that the $10 a gallon gas was absolutely the biggest lever to change people's choice of transportation choices.
Saving money is really key. Really key. Now here's where we found we weren't doing so well, though, in terms of our outreach. Less than 2 in 10 are aware of guaranteed ride home services. And guaranteed ride home is for the folks that are riding those carpools and vanpools and public transportation. Your boss needs you to work late, you say, hey, I'm going to miss my bus, I can't do it. The Guaranteed Ride Home program enables you to get home, either by a taxi or a rental car or somebody, you know, or we find a way to put you on public transportation. So it's a very valuable program, but we're not doing a good enough job about the outreach and letting people know it. And if we do a better job of that, people will be more confident about, I can take public transportation and I don't have to worry about what happens if my boss says I got to work late. I'll still be able to get home. And so these programs are vital, they're very important, and we've got to do a better job of educating the public about it. So that tells us where our outreach dollars need to go. Key finding number three, this is where the private sector comes in. Really interesting message here, I think. Employer involvement lifts participation in the transportation choices. Basically, from the survey respondents, 43% of them said that their employer provides commuter services. And basically, what we're talking about here is at least some sort of subsidy for transit or van pools, commuting information. Some of them have their own rideshare databases if they're a big enough employer to help their employees figure out how to carpool. Preferential parking for carpoolers and van poolers. Guaranteed ride home, which I just covered. You see in Northern Virginia, you've got an even bigger lift where it's 43% overall in the state, but 51% in Northern Virginia. I suspect that when the mega projects come any day now, we're going to see it go even higher. And that's what we're starting to gear our programs. We've got a number of programs that are designed to assist employers, help them figure out how to start these programs, how to offer these services. And so we know that we've got a good chunk of them out there participating in it. And the effect of them participating in it is substantial. We know that the use of transportation choices are twice as high when the commute services are available. Employers provide a tremendous amount of influence on getting their employees into transportation choices. So they can really put services and the benefits out there that are going to attract people out of their single occupant vehicles and into the transportation choices we're looking for them to be in. Key finding number four, telework has tremendous growth potential. I think we always suspected it, but we didn't quite quantify it, and now we have. Overall, 1 in 10 Virginia workers telework, 1 in 10. In Northern Virginia, it's 2 in 10, which is one of the highest figures in the nation. Now, in terms of how much they telework, that's any frequency, but on average, the teleworking days per week is about 1.5. So that's going to continue to grow, I think, especially in Northern Virginia when the mega projects. Our research specific to Northern Virginia, that was the number one thing survey respondents said that they were interested in doing when the mega projects came in Northern Virginia. All of that construction, all that traffic, they wanted to know how to telework. Was the number one thing they wanted to do. So we know for a fact that teleworking replaces nearly 6%, again, a very significant figure, of weekly commute trips in Virginia. That equates to about 438,000 teleworkers. But even more importantly, we asked them if their job responsibilities were such that they could and would telework if they were given the opportunity. Nearly 25% of them said they would. That equates to an additional 751,000 potential new teleworkers. So 438,000 out there right now, taking 6% of the trips off the road, there's another potential 751,000 out there. So we know that our telework programs have a lot of opportunity out there. Mr. Schwartz.
Corey, you know, an interesting follow-up study, just a smaller study, would be to double back to employers, because your statistics show that there's a substantial pent-up demand of workers who feel that they could and would telecommute. It'd be interesting to go to the employers and do a survey of them, both public and private sector, CEOs as well as middle managers, if you could, and really find out what they need to be able to allow more of their workforce to telecommute. And I don't, you know, I have some thoughts, but I don't know exactly, I don't think any of us know exactly what those needs are, but because that I think is in many respects the real key to boosting that number. It's not the employees, it's that they need the employers to bless their ability to do that.
Absolutely, and that's what our Telework Virginia program is all about, is providing the technical assistance coming to the employer site and just giving them education materials and teaching them how do you allow a teleworking arrangement. You get the managers that say, well, you know, my employees are going to be home in their pajamas all day. We come to them and say, here's how you can properly manage your employees while they're teleworking, and give them the kind of educational tools that they need to get comfortable with that. And that's, again, there's a major push right now in Northern Virginia for the mega projects to do exactly that. We have people that are on the street every day talking to employers, but we need to do more. There's certainly a lot of opportunity there. Last key finding for you, investment in transportation choices has broad-based support. It's no longer the highway folks that drive alone want more highways and the transit people want more transit. We see from this chart here that basically 8 out of 10 believe, regardless of whether I drive alone or whether I use some other transportation choice, that investment in transportation choices is important and should continue. So we've got real strong support, no matter who you are out there, for investing in the transportation choices. And the reason why they think it's a good idea, regardless of how they commute, is because they believe the transportation choices reduce congestion. It's the number one thing that they all cited. So this is my last slide. This is the rip it out of your book and put it in your briefcase and carry it around with you. Five key findings. Number one, when it comes to the work trips, Virginians are embracing the transportation choices that you're funding. People want to know, are those programs really working? Yes, they're working. Infrastructure and outreach are key for transportation choices. We've got to have HOV systems that connect. We've got to have outreach campaigns that are educating the public of the services that are out there. Number three, employer involvement list participation. Participation twice as high in transportation choices when those services are offered. Number four, telework. Potentially 750,000 new teleworkers out there. And number five, 8 out of 10 people think, yes, you're doing the right thing. Keep investing in the transportation choices. So with that, I'll conclude. And the last thing I just wanted to note is that while the survey is a 2007 survey, and we finished the analysis in 2008, we've been using the data and working aggressively with it. And what we've done is for every single major market in Northern Virginia, we have customized, using the survey respondents in those markets, presentations for the TDM agencies, the MPOs, the transit operators, and so on and so forth, so that they can see specifically for their market, how did people respond to these questions. So I have copies of all of these. If any of you would like one for your specific area, be happy to provide it to you, walk you through it, answer any of the questions you might have. We also have such a robust database. Again, the original presentation was 140 slides. So we can cross-tab anything. So if you have additional questions, there's a good chance I can run a cross-tab for you and get write down specific to a particular issue.
Mr. McCarthy. We're going back, Corey, to one of your earlier slides that you emphasized to us. Wouldn't you say that, whether you call it a key finding or a key marketing device, that saving money is a driver, in fact, the most important driver for all of this?
Yes.
People don't always think that. You know. And plus, there's another fact, I don't know if you've asked about it, but convenience is another factor that trumps sometimes almost everything else. So between saving money and making it convenient, there's sometimes a bit of a tension there, but it seems to me saving money is something to keep crowing about.
Absolutely.
To push people in this direction, and making it more convenient will also do the same thing.
Absolutely, and that's where we're trying to work with our local folks that, again, there's so much push out there about put your dollars into go green, go green, go green, but what we're finding is that's an important message. It's number two on our list, but really pound that message of convenience and saving time,
well,
because that's resonating with people more.
I will say that the polling that my organization has done over the years shows that the way to succeed in going green is not to say be virtuous and be green, but it's to show you how it saves you money, real money, out of your pocket.
Yes.
And if there's a green benefit, that's wonderful, and we want to see that, but that's not the sales pitch.
Right.
And so it's nice to see that confirmed, but don't knock it. The point is, saving money is the thing that people really pay attention to.
Right. Positioning.
Price.
Ms. Connor.
Mr. Chairman, Corey, do we have any way to incentivize the employers to do the things that you note on slide 13, like his subsidies for van pools and all that? Do we just have moral and this is how you do it, or is there something in our tax code or in a way that we can give them incentives for doing some of these things that I think are really excellent ideas?
There's a few things out there. Certainly our Telework Virginia program does provide a financial incentive for employers to set up a teleworking program, and we can come back and give you some real details on exactly, you know, how much money we've awarded and exactly how many teleworkers we've gotten as a result of that. We can provide that information for you. Also, one of the most important things that I think some people overlooked in the whole economic stimulus package was the fact that there's long been a disparity between the tax benefit that employers can provide for parking for their employees versus a transit benefit. It's been about half that. Uh-huh. It was equalized in the Recovery Act. So now there's a lot more pressure for the employees are putting a lot more pressure to say, hey, bring me up to that same level that you give the guys that drive by themselves and park, because one of the most interesting anecdotes I think PRTC provided was that what happens in Prince William County is people get that benefit and they use it to ride commuter buses downtown, but that benefit doesn't pay for their transit fare completely for the month. When that runs out, what they end up doing is they end up slugging, carpooling or vanpooling or something of that. With this equalization, we are now expecting PRTC ridership to grow even more because now they're not essentially getting kicked off the bus. Mm-hmm. They'll have enough money to fully fund their fare. So there's going to be some really interesting dynamics there. I think the employer is going to continue to hear from the employees. They want that benefit. It's going to be incredibly important in the urban areas for retaining employees, and that's part of what we talk to the employers about. These programs are about employee retention, employee morale, employee productivity, a number of things like that. Those are the kind of messages we talk about, and we try to explain to them how providing these types of incentives will save them money in the end and make them a much more productive and profitable business.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the issue of the van pools was raised, and it's always been my understanding that one of the challenges here has been the insurance for van pools. If you operate a van pool, or certainly if you operate more than your own personal van pool, that there was only a single insurance company out there was carrying it, and rates were getting high, which was driving people out. My understanding, Virginia's now sort of stepped in to provide that. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, you're exactly correct. There was a time where we got very nervous because we had such a robust van pool market there that we were down to one insurance provider, and if that insurance provider decided any day just to stop, that all of a sudden we'd be putting 500 van pools back into cars and having a significant impact. And so, yes, we did start a program that provides kind of a backstop for insurance so that we can make sure that we're not totally at the whim of one company going away and the opportunity disappearing. So we do have a program that covers that.
In terms of I guess it was slide 22, you got infrastructure and outreach, and as part of the infrastructure you mentioned that one of the significant incentives for people deciding to carpool is the carpool lots.
Yes.
That begs the question, what are we doing in terms of, because I know a lot of them are at capacity.
They are.
And while we've got some planned as part of the hot lanes,
right,
that's along a particular corridor. What's our plan overall on the other commuter lines, whether it's 66 or otherwise, to actually expand the car lots?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think we really need to do a better partnering job with VDOT on. Typically what happens is we're addressing the park and ride lot needs through key corridor studies like 95, 395, like 66, rather than doing more of a comprehensive type of park and ride lot type of survey. So we need to do more work there. VDOT is more involved, frankly, in park and ride lots than we are specifically. But we need to partner with them with this kind of information and kind of work on that a lot harder, because one of the other things that we put in, found out from the survey that I didn't get a chance to put in the presentation, is that only 3 out of 10 people even know if they have a park and ride lot that's along their route. So even if we have the park and ride lot, we haven't done an effective enough job to communicate to them that one's available for them to use. So again, back to outreach, not doing a good enough job on letting them know, hey, there's park and ride lots that are available along your route, and there's transit that serves it, or there's slugging or carpooling or vanpooling opportunities.
But I guess the challenge is, although in some cases those lots exist
they're at or they're beyond capacity. You've got cars being, it's kind of a strange disincentive. You've got local authorities that are towing cars away because they're illegally parked at the car lot on the shoulders, but we're trying to get more people to do that. So what are we doing on the capacity side? And I know that kind of a regional issue.
Right, and again, it's being addressed mainly at the corridor level, but we need to do more work to address it at the regional level.
I believe on that issue that we just authorized about $100,000 study in the Fredericksburg area to identify additional commuter lots. I'd love to have a discussion sometime about the art and the science of locating commuter parking lots.
Oh, it's never
been. Where they work. Yeah. Look at the successful ones. They're all right where very successful retail is. And so successful commuter lots are in competition for scarce real estate. If they're remote and away from the areas, they are typically not used. So they're expensive real estate acquisitions.
Yeah.
We are trying to address some of that need also through long-range plans that we've asked the TDM agencies to do, so in the Fredericksburg area. We've asked them to take a look at what their needs are, but the Secretary is exactly right. We can identify those needs, but then we have to have the resources to act on them and act on them quickly. And often where people have cobbled together park and ride lots at shopping malls, you are at the whim, just like at Potomac Mills, who recently made the decision, you know, we're not going to do this anymore, we're only going to give you this many versus that many. And so we need a more structured approach that allows us to respond in a more comprehensive way.
I have no idea. This one thing I've found is, you know, people, I've seen people try to push for, well, we'll have a 50-car park and ride. That doesn't work real well when you're trying to get, enough people there to actually produce slug lines that people are relying upon. You've got to have much more than that. Do we have any kind of studies that show how big a lot needs to be before it becomes sufficient, sustaining in that manner?
That's an excellent question, but I'm not aware, Dan, are you? Yeah, that's an excellent question.
I think we could go out to the successful slug lines, and that's an excellent question. You're right. You have to achieve a critical mass, and you have to have supporting bus service for slugging to work. Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. One, to follow up on your observation about the connection between retail. My guess is there are a lot of shopping malls with a lot of extra spaces these days. If some of the statistics we see in the industry, which is that we're about 20% overstored, and that's particularly true in some of the shopping malls, it's just an interesting thought, but there may be existing parking spaces, substantial numbers of existing parking spaces in some of those malls that they, at this point, would be delighted to enter into long-term leases that would give them a revenue stream today, basically rent parking spaces that aren't being used, knowing that, eventually some additional level of sales will come back. But in a lot of cases, the amount of parking required by municipalities for these projects is beyond anything that they need except, maybe 1 or 2 days a year. So just to follow up on your thought, there may be opportunities for the Commonwealth to enter into long-term leases for parking spaces for these lots rather than have to spend the money of building them. It might be a whole lot cheaper. It's just something to think about. And it may be an opportunity that's there today, won't be there in 2 or 3 years. That was the first thing. Corey, a question for you. The survey that you did, how far out into the exurbs did the survey go? For example, for around Washington, did you survey people out as far as Fauquier County, where I live, or Frederick County, which has many commuters, or Warren County? I'm just curious how far out your survey went.
Yeah, again, we have the breakdown for specific markets of Stanton, Culpeper, you name it. We've got it, and we've also got a breakdown of the sampling. So we've got Charlottesville, Culpeper, Fredericksburg, Front Royal, Hampton Roads, Middle Peninsula, Northern Neck, Richmond, Roanoke, Prince William, Loudoun, Fairfax, Arlington, Alexandria, so a pretty decent sample around the state.
Okay. And the other thing, it was occurring to me, two thoughts. One, you were talking about getting the word out more on a lot of these programs. Think about what you can do to partner with local government on that, because local government has a huge incentive to encourage things like telecommuting and so forth. It's not just the wear and tear and overuse of the main arterials that are caused by the commuting load. It's also a lot of local infrastructure. So you might find that local governments might be more active, proactive, willing partners in terms of getting the word out. The other thing is just going back to the telework, telecommute thing. You were talking about, you know, going in to see employers and have conversations with them about how they could more effectively implement telework programs. But I wouldn't overlook just paying them. Ms. Connolly asked the question about incentives, and I wanted to follow up on that. It would be really interesting to try to quantify, in effect, what it's worth to the Commonwealth to take a commuter off the road. I don't know what that number is, $500 a year, $1,000 a year. If you take a commuter off the road, you create road capacity. It may be worth looking at a model where we can really see what it would be worth to the Commonwealth to do that, and then look at maybe making some of these incentive programs more robust and in a situation where even though we're paying out more money, it's a fraction of the cost of creating that capacity by building the kind of infrastructure, roads and so forth, that we traditionally have to build to meet that demand. So I think there's a lot of interesting places that that could go, and it would be great to have you report back to us from time to time on your additional thoughts in that area.
I'd be happy to do that, and we have actually calculated the return on investment for the telework program, so I'll provide that information.
I would love to see that.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
And then just one other small note on the park and ride lots. We do work with our local TDM agencies to try to do the kind of partnerships that you're talking about. Sometimes they're successful in securing them without even having to pay for it. You know, there's just a good community neighbor kind of thing. But the other thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, you get into those shopping seasons, you know, Christmas, and all of a sudden they don't want us there anymore. But one of the more interesting opportunities that's out there, especially in the Northern Virginia market, you've got some churches that have absolutely enormous parking lots, absolutely enormous. And so the churches are another great
that
opportunity.
That are mostly used only on the weekend. They're
mostly used on Sunday.
Yeah.
And so there typically is not much of a problem with us using them during.
That's a good idea.
But they are concerned about their property, making sure that people obviously respect it, and that it's clean and things like that. And that's where some of those agreements come into play, to make sure that we respect that.
Okay, any additional questions or comments? Thank you so much. I'll be happy at some point to discuss. I have a lot of painful history on a lot of these subjects in particular.
Sure you do.
The leasing of commuter spaces does not have a good history. And at the end of whatever term of lease you get to, there's a gun to your head when you have 1,000 angry commuters. And so a smart businessman would enter that deal today for a guaranteed, a balloon payment. If
I could see the pain on your face,
yes,
as you were saying.
If it's okay with folks, what I would like to do, we've got time for one more presentation, to jump down to item number 11, if Dr. Tischer is still here and her team, to talk about the Route 29 update, and then we'll pick up the remainder of items tomorrow morning, if that's acceptable, folks.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I will be providing an update and an overview of the status of the Route 29 corridor study. Charlie Rasnick is the project manager for the Commonwealth, and if Charlie will... there he is. And then Joe Springer is the consultant manager of the study, and we'll be hearing from them in a little bit. The presentation today is going to be providing you a background and the study goals, then talk a little bit about the listening tours, the regional leaders planning meetings that we've had, some of the common issues and concerns, consensus themes that are being developed for Route 29, and then end with next steps. The corridor extends for 219 miles in the Commonwealth, going all the way from North Carolina up to I-66 near Gainesville. It's designated as a national highway system route. It serves long-distance travel and also carries large volumes of local traffic, and there is a parallel rail service along the corridor. The study goal is to prepare a blueprint for the future along the corridor, taking into consideration the short term being about 0 to 10 years, and then the intermediate time frame, 10 to 20, and then the vision, which is beyond 20 years. And the goal here is to prevent us from developing short-term improvements that foreclose the opportunity to achieve the vision that is ultimately identified. The study is in three phases. The first one is identifying the needs and establishing the planning framework. The second is developing recommendation, and we have a very significant public involvement process to do that and to review and refine the recommendations. And a key component of the first phase of the study was the listening tour in public meetings. And I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Springer and ask him to overview that process.
Welcome, Mr. Springer.
Thank you. The process that we put in place for this study was a very deliberate process in terms of going out to folks and asking them what the needs were, what the particular issues were, and those kinds of things before we ever got to the point of talking about specific improvements. So the eight public meetings that we held as part of what we call the listening tour in the study were held in late February and early March. We held eight meetings going from south to north. And really this was part of the process of kind of identifying the issues. We also had a number of meetings with the planning district commissions and the MPO areas, as well as some individual meetings with several key stakeholder groups. Some of the things we asked folks at those meetings are listed here. Really, you know, why is the corridor important to you? What are the things that you want to preserve? What are the things that we need to focus on in the study? How is the corridor used? We had a questionnaire that we asked folks both at the meetings. We had a version online as well. What are the goals for the corridor in terms of safe and efficient transportation, both existing and future? And we also had a stack of aerial photography for the entire 219-mile corridor. And we asked folks both generally and specifically to identify areas, particular problem areas in terms of congestion and safety. At these same meetings, we had information related to some of the key aspects of the corridor itself in terms of number of crashes throughout the corridor, driveway density throughout the corridor, overall traffic volumes throughout the corridor, and certainly there's a wide variety of diversity in terms of the physical characteristics of the corridor, and we certainly heard a wide variety of input in terms of folks about things we need to be concerned about, things that they felt were important, and things that we need to consider as we develop recommendations. Some of the common issues and concerns that came out of those meetings are listed up here. One of the key things that came out fairly consistently is the top item of concern related to safety, issues related to particularly speed limits and the truck traffic and the sort of the confluence of high truck traffic, some of the older geometry of the roadway, and combined with some of the high number of driveways really created some safety issues throughout the corridor. Congestion in some spot locations. There are five areas that kind of were raised perhaps the most through the corridor. The one going south to north in Pennsylvania County, the area called Tight Squeeze was one. The area in Campbell County just south of Lynchburg on 29 was another one. The area north of Charlottesville was the third one. The area around Rutgersville was the fourth one. And the area up in Gainesville between 50 and 66 was kind of cited as one of the other ones. All those locations we are looking at in substantially more detail as a result of that. Issues related to the proliferation of traffic signals. I think that sort of became a phrase that people used to latch onto and make it clear that they really didn't like traffic signals, and they certainly didn't like the fact that every time they turned around, there seemed to be more popping up. So it turned out to be kind of a bad word as we went through the process. But other issues related to need for bypasses, I think most folks are aware. Certainly, one of the lightning rod points was the issue of the bypass around Charlottesville, and certainly there are a lot of folks who were adamant that something needed to be done through that area. Other areas in terms of bypasses, certainly up in the northern part of the corridor between 15 and west of 15 up to 66, the so-called Buckland Bypass was something that was raised quite a bit as well. We also had, while we weren't talking about specific recommendations, we did have a lot of concerns about the impacts of potential recommendations that we may be coming up with related to preserving historic resources, scenic resources, maintaining the rural character of the corridor. And certainly, last but not least, and these really aren't in any particular order other than perhaps the first one, the issue related to certainly economic development. Other items, lack of modal choices, sort of leads on from some of the discussion earlier. There was kind of a 50-50 mix in terms of some of the feedback we got on surveys about folks didn't use transit because it wasn't available or perhaps it wasn't... didn't fit within lifestyle, but overall there was certainly a concern, depending on the area, there was a desire to look at additional modal choices. That really is one of our key points in this study in terms of looking at ways to address that. Growth management, and then just listed here some major needs that were identified. We heard a lot about a need for a master plan for the entire corridor in terms of both transportation and land use. Need to preserve right-of-way. We spent a lot of time talking about establishing a grid system, which is part of what the Places 29 study in Charlottesville is looking at, developing parallel roadways so that not all the development and not all the transportation has to fit on one corridor through the area. Developing potential alternative corridors. Certainly we heard from folks about looking at other potential mid-state type north-south corridors to be looking at. And then last but not least, the additional rail service. Certainly a lot of support for the additional rail service that's coming, as well as some concern, particularly in the southern part of the corridor, that service does not extend all the way down to Danville, and that we need to address that in some way perhaps through bus service. Following those eight meetings we had in late February and early March, we had a series of four meetings in late March and early April. We just wrapped those up a couple of weeks ago. Those were basically three and a half hour workshops. We invited elected officials to come, but we also opened it up to the public. We also sent out invitations to planning commissioners and major stakeholders, chambers of commerce, and those kinds of folks. What we did at those sessions was really look at the corridor as a whole, as well as regionally, ask folks to think a little bit outside of the box in terms of some of the things that they would recommend to their particular area, as well as the state as a whole. And the primary goal of that process really was to start identifying issues and get some good conversation going relative to the planning processes as well as some policy and procedure type things. We did have an exercise, sort of a what-if exercise, taking the folks through a process of looking at how some of the decisions are made, perhaps 90% of the time or more, and really that kind of got people realizing just how at the local level in particular, it's a very much a short-term kind of vision that folks have when you make decisions. You're making decisions based on what's in front of you at the time, and that makes it hard to think long-term, particularly at the local level. The key thing that we wanted to do and get out of those workshops was developing some consensus themes. Obviously, 219 miles of corridor, connecting some of the fastest-growing parts of the state with some of the slower-growing parts of the state. It's a challenge to get some of those, but I think we've had some pretty good success in identifying some preliminary consensus themes. This is a slide with a lot of words on it, but I'll just sort of summarize. They can be summarized relatively quickly. The key thing that I heard from most of the folks is really a need to identify a minimal level of access control. In terms of a vision, and we were using the term managed access, which really we were defining for the purpose of these workshops is access only at designated secondary road intersections. So anything between those secondary road intersections would not be, you would not have access, or at most it would be right in, right out type access. There was a common understanding really of the need to have established limits for maximum acceptable delays so that you're dealing with the local trips, but when you put that sort of thinking in place, you're also addressing delays for your longer distance trips. So the idea being that really we need to look at the maximum level of delays and do things, put things in place in terms of the planning process so that when those maximum levels of delays are achieved, Then you look for making intersection improvements, parallel roadways, construction of interchanges, those kinds of things. Developing a corridor-wide master plan, something that was raised, I think, at all of our workshops, that addresses both transportation and land use throughout the corridor. The fourth bullet we also heard from a lot of folks and worded in different ways, but the idea being that overall this is a state road and BDOT needs to increase their ownership of the road and treat it as an investment that needs to be preserved and work with local governments in terms of doing that. We had some specifics in terms of what people thought we ought to do to achieve that, and I think we had some interesting ideas that we're going to be exploring over the next couple months. Other consensus themes, identify and implement alternative methods to manage access. Some of the things that were listed out for purchasing development rights, incentives for access to take place on roads other than Route 29 itself, incentives to develop a grid system over time being another aspect of it. The rail system, really throughout the corridor, there's a lot of interest in expanding the rail system and increasing the capacity of the rail system and looking for ways to time the implementation of improvements so that you enhance the competitive advantage of the rail and transit and other modes, so that perhaps rather than widening the road first, you look for other methods to try to take care of some of that demand before you do the other to get folks out of their cars. And then finally, managing growth in terms of where you put some of the land use and developing nodal type activity centers. This just lists out some of the broad recommendations, categories that we are going to be working on over the next couple months and developing some specifics with in terms of, and part of that we're doing with one-on-one meetings with the localities, land use and transportation planning. This study really has a pretty extensive look at the land use side of things, so that's one of our key features, I think, that's going to be coming out of this report. Economic development, transit opportunities, roadway improvements, spot improvements, going back to what Mary Lynn mentioned, just starting off in terms of the short, mid, and long term, a lot of those things, some of the congestion improvements and safety improvements may be more in the short and mid term, whereas some of the other things may be in the longer term. Regional collaboration, we've talked a lot at the regional workshops about policy changes and legislation and those kinds of things, and those are things we're going to be spending some time again over the next couple of months developing more specifics for. The next steps in terms of what we're looking to do is develop the overall planning framework so that as we develop projects, we that's providing the framework to guide our discussion and put a context around everything, and that really is going to be a toolbox of projects, policies, legislation, actions, those kinds of things. Developing specifics with respect to those toolbox items, including time frames, potential costs, things that need to be involved in terms of additional discussions and those kinds of things. One of the key things that we came into the study recognizing is that there are a lot of studies that have been done in the corridor before, and one of our jobs really is to look at those studies and assess the applicability and effectiveness of those recommendations and look at what they do for the state as a whole on 29. Identify and address conflicts between some of the near-term economic development opportunities and the appropriate local, regional, statewide roles for 29. Clearly, we identified through this process some of the things, the dynamics that come into play in terms of looking at short-term, more local opportunities as opposed to some of the long-range statewide opportunities. Assessing new access management standards, there is the current access management regulations in place. We want to look at certainly how those are working, what people think of them, and whether we need to potentially strengthen those, particularly for key corridors like Route 29. One-on-one meetings, we are going to meet one-on-one with all the counties and the cities through the corridor come up with specifics of these recommendations. And then what we want to do is sort of establish the initial initial footings, I guess, of a master plan for the corridor that perhaps after we've done this study can be taken further. So that's a summary of kind of where we've been and where we're going. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Booth.
Did you identify any sources of money to pay for these, implementing these ideas? And secondly, did you determine how this might affect other north-south routes? Would it take some of the load off of, for example, 81 or 95 or Route 1?
The answer to the first question, it is in our scope to look at funding issues and financing. I'm not sure how detailed we're going to be able to get into that, but it is something we're looking at, and we'll certainly look at what's been done in other corridors throughout the country and come up with some new ideas and things that might be considered. In terms of the, sorry, what was the second question?
Will this divert traffic off some other north-south routes?
Certainly it will, and part of what we were building on is other studies. Back in 2003, phases 2 and 3 of the Route 29 corridor study was done. That was something we were involved in. There was some analysis of potential diversion from 81 and 95 and some of the other roads in the state. Those diversions varied. They were, as you went further south, they became much smaller. It was 29 and 81 separate quite a bit as you go further south. I don't know that that's a big issue in terms of what we're looking at for this study, but it is something we're considering.
Thank
you. Mr. McCarthy.
Hello.
Could I add something to that, if I may? And that is that the freight study that we're doing is also looking at diversion of freight, and it found not significant amounts of diversions from 29 and 81. So if that helps.
I want to take this opportunity to say this study and the solutions you might eventually find might be a good place to where VDOT has been recently embracing roundabouts. This looks like a Carter begging for some roundabouts. Yeah. I hope you won't forget that. As
all the way around Charlottesville.
Ms. Short.
Just an observation that goes to both Jim's and Jerry's comment, one about funding and the other about roundabouts, is whether the roundabouts or whatever they may be, looking for coming up with some prototypical design solutions to address the plethora of traffic signals, I think is a critical thing to look at, one, because it addresses the throughput issue, and roundabouts can do that. But the other thing is, because we all recognize that there isn't going to be one massive amount of funding to fix this corridor, if we have solutions that are very scalable, in other words, we have prototypes for intersections that can really help, that maybe cost $5 to $15 million, depending on where they are, you know, where every time you get that much money, you can solve a problem and make it better. You don't have to wait until you have the $200 or $300 million that we'll never have. So scalable solutions, I think, is something that that I think we might ultimately find, you know, very useful in this thing.
Yeah, I think, and all sorts of different solutions. I mean, we'll develop sort of prototypes, as you said, cross-sections, those kinds of things. Obviously, we can't design the entire corridor in this study.
No, just
we can identify a prototype. We can identify logical locations.
Right, and, you know, we've all recognized, as we've looked at this, there isn't going to be any kind of one-size-fits-all solution, but to the extent you can facilitate the process by having some different kinds of prototypes that might work in particular locations, I think that would really advance the ball.
Mr.
I'll yield to my comment.
Mr. White.
I would just like to observe, Mr. Chairman, the effectiveness of this study so far today in my district. Early on, we had an interest group or two that was headed off the reservation, so they're back, and I think participating in a very positive way in the study. Mr. Springer and Mr. Rasnick and their team are to be congratulated for the all-inclusive approach they have been taking. And I've been to some of the meetings in my district. Mr. Davies even came to one of our meetings. I haven't had the courage to go to any meetings. That may change. But I just want to commend you gentlemen and your team for the work you're doing, and we'll look forward to your next progress report. Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other observation. I participated in some of these discussions that Joe's described wearing my local government hat, and there were a number of other local government officials in some of these sessions. And I will tell you that I was surprised and pleasantly surprised to see the level of support in one form or another. It wasn't always said the same way, for a real serious commitment to addressing the land use planning issue along the Carter. You might have thought going into this that that was going to be a sort of an insurmountable problem, the desire of the Commonwealth in terms of the need for throughput and the unwillingness of municipalities to cede any level of land use and land planning control along the corridor. And, well, Joe, you saw this, and Mary Lynn and Charlie. There were a number of these discussions where it was not that black and white at all, and I think that there is, what it said to me is there really is fruitful opportunity to work that as a combination of both rules and incentives. And in some cases, there are local officials along the corridor who, frankly, would really like to see better land planning, and in some cases, some stricter rules as well as incentives give them both the cover and the opportunity to do that that they might not otherwise have. So that was one of the things that has very pleasantly surprised me in terms of the discussions I've attended.
Yeah, I think the level of consensus has actually even been more than I was hoping for. So
yeah.
I've been very pleased as well.
As they say, the blindfold does sharpen one's attention. Mr. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Springer, thank you. First of all, I'd like to put a personal plea in for a preliminary consensus theme, including access to pig and steak under all circumstances.
Will do. So noted.
I have a question on nomenclature. You talk about managed access here, and another term is limited access. Is there a scale you're talking about there that is normal in the consulting business?
It's a very hard thing to pin down. We whenever we talk about those, we try and use the term and then define it because everybody uses them differently. This one I use managed here on this slide. I would actually call that controlled myself, but I would use managed here because it's what we use in the workshop, so okay. I want to be consistent there. But
do you expect to get either in the short term or long term the vision a description that is more positive, for example, like free flowing, or that gives people some sense of how it would actually function as opposed to how it would be controlled?
Good point. Yeah, we could. That may be a better way to put it. We're working with, and I didn't mention it here, we're working right now with four basic performance measures. Travel time, so we want to minimize travel time. Delays, we're measuring delays separately simply because delays of signals are perceived differently in terms of delay. Modal choice, I think a broad performance measure is increasing modal choices, and then safety. So I think within what you mentioned in terms of using those first two in particular, minimizing travel time and delay, that's a good point. We could perhaps shift the work.
The final observation is I think there's a real opportunity here to emphasize what VDOT ownership means, and I would recommend it to my colleagues, the commissioner, and to the department, that it's not just having the money to do things, it actually is having a strong enough concept that enrolls other people. And I think we're on a very good track here. This is going to be something that, in fact, may be a more important function of the board and the department going forward than just the money.
Mm-hmm.
If we can help create the vehicles and the consensus and the toolbox and so forth. So I'm very encouraged by the progress that's been made so far. I think it's a good model for some other partners we're going to look at here.
Mr. Davies.
I think it's good that we have heard that we think we are building consensus. I have noted that in a number of the meetings, there have been no local elected officials from some of the jurisdictions. And I have followed up with those jurisdictions, since some of them are in the Culpeper District. And I think we've got to be careful that we don't get what we got from the last study, where you have phase one with an inability to reach a consensus, and phase two, where you had a consensus south of Charlottesville. And I think the meetings that you're going to hold with local governments individually are going to be critical to getting them to sign on to that consensus. What is important for us, I think, to understand is that some of the local governments, they have been sending their staff to the meetings. It's true in a number of jurisdictions where the local supervisors or town council members have not gone. So I've gone to them and said, well, why weren't you there? And they said, well, we wanted our staff to go educate us, and we didn't want to have to sign on to anything. I think there is going to be a real effort needed to produce that consensus, and I think that's a challenge. It was true. I went down to Lynchburg. I think there was one elected official.
More than that, I think it was three.
Oh, Shannon Valentine was there, but
and
there.
In addition to her.
Yeah, it was, but it was a very limited group of people who were there. So as you develop concepts, there were general reactions. People didn't. They wanted you to figure out a way to get trucks off the road to minimize it. They wanted to stop the signal proliferation. There are target things that there was general consensus about, but I think there is some real risk. Those individual meetings with the local governments are going to be key in developing a broader consensus, especially as you go north.
Yeah, the conversations I've had with the localities is for those one-on-ones, we would like at least some representation from the Board of Supervisors, the Planning Commission, as well as the staff level, just for that reason. We had the best representation we had from elected officials in terms of percent of people at the meeting was actually down in Chatham and in Charlottesville. The other two was a little we certainly would have liked to have had a lot more.
How many members of the General Assembly have attended?
Shannon Valentine came to the one in Lynchburg. We had, I forget the gentleman's name, in Chatham. That may have been it, actually.
Three or four out of 140? And they're the owners?
Well, yeah, in the Carter meeting.
They're right there, members of the board, is the issue.
But they're not 140 in the Carter.
I understand.
But there are those who have a vested interest who were aware of the meeting, who got calls in advance of the meeting, and they didn't even send a member of their staff or their legislative aide to the meeting.
As I recall, we kicked off this study with a joint meeting of affected legislators in this very room, and they pledged their support and participation. One of the things, you mentioned the term ownership. The ownership of this road vests with the Commonwealth and ultimately with the General Assembly. I would certainly entertain a resolution from the board to communicate to the members, the General Assembly members in this quarter about previous meetings and encouraging their participation.
So moved.
Is that for tomorrow or for today? Let's do that tomorrow, probably. We'll get that drawn up. If I may, this is a very important issue, and ownership was mentioned as an important issue here. We can't be talking about an issue like this without the owners being properly represented. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for getting the study off to a great start. Okay, it's about 4:30. Mary Lynn, how long is your other presentation? Is that a long one or a short one? Can we do that? We can do this resource allocation. We'll be done by 5 o'clock, and we'll make for a quick meeting tomorrow.
Basically. Oh, sure.
They're going to win.
Oh, then they should. Okay, welcome, Dr. Tischer. This is the final workshop presentation. This is just a quick overview of the multimodal planning allocations and the recommendations and next steps for this year's funding allocation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to present an overview of the multimodal fund that has been provided in the Appropriations Act, essentially summarize the history of the fund, describe past and current uses of the monies, provide recommendations for fiscal year 09, and also discuss next steps. The purpose, as defined in the Appropriations Act, of the multimodal fund is for the planning and evaluation of options to address transportation needs. In the 2006 Appropriations Act, $5 million was were provided for in 08, $6 million in 07, and then again the 2009 Appropriations Act provided $4 million for fiscal year 09 and another $4 million for fiscal year 10. In addition, and that should be $1 million each year for advance activities, which had been initiated in 2006 and it is repeated again in this Appropriation Act. And I am before you because the Act also requires that someone from the Intermodal Planning and Investment Office make recommendations to the Board on how to use the funding. The fiscal year 07 and 08 allocations were used as follows. Approximately $5.5 million for required projects. And by required projects, those are things that were identified to be accomplished in law or through executive order. So we used the funding for the statewide multimodal freight study, for the performance report to begin the multimodal long-range planning effort, and then also for advanced activities, which is essentially for the development of improvements and analysis prior to the design of an individual existing corridor. We allocated $500,000 for the training and the support of traffic studies, essentially referred to as the 527 traffic impact analyses. And $250,000 was used for a study for the economic impact of the investment in transportation. And then approximately a little less than $5 million for two grant programs. The distinguishing element between the two of them was whether or not the locality used its own consultant or whether they employed the consultant that was hired by the Commonwealth. The goal of the grant programs was to assist localities in planning multimodally and linking land use with transportation decisions. We received 81 applications for $12.6 million. We awarded 31 for about $5 million. Six of the grants studies are completed and are on the Office of the Intermodal Planning and Investment website under the grant program. This is a map, and the little green dots indicate the grantees around the state. There were eight grants to develop land use and transportation plans, five to introduce multimodal planning into the corridor, eight to advance transit, three to develop bicycle and or pedestrian plans, and one was a ferry plan. And another, a grantee, was assessing the strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and then five were preparing freight studies. This is the list of the grant studies that have been completed, and I'll talk about a couple of them. The New River Valley Planning District Commission performed an employment mobility study. They coordinated with the providers, analyzed commuting patterns, and recommended seven new routes to address some of those needs. The Virginia Regional Transit Development Plan identifies a series of improvements to the transit system beyond what they were currently enjoying. For example, one recommendation was to convert the Waynesboro demand response service to deviated fixed route service in an attempt to serve more customers and then also provide more efficient service. Caroline County, a transit-oriented development study evaluated the concept of a transit village in Carmel Church, including a potential rail station. They identified several sites, land uses within half-mile radius of the proposed station, developed circulation plans, made recommendations. And one of the interesting things, I think, about this particular study is that they used this as a feasibility study, determined that such a transit opportunity was feasible. They received a second grant from the Department of Rail and Public Transportation to provide a more in-depth study, and they are now at the point where they have received an earmark to perform environmental analysis, so they are moving forward on this. This gives you an idea of the essentially the, how they identified some of the land uses that would be appropriate around the different rail stations. And that moves me into the 2009 recommendations. We are proposing support for localities to address the urban development areas for $3 million, reserving $1 million for advanced activities to provide $500,000 for a much reduced, unfortunately, grant program, and then support for the intermodal office to continue the multimodal long-range plan and to perform regional performance measures and other items as needed. House Bill 3202 requires cities, counties, and towns with a population that's above 20,000 and a growth of 5% or a growth of 15% to amend the comprehensive plans to incorporate urban development areas. A UDA is an area designated appropriate for higher density development due to proximity to transportation facilities, the availability of sewer and water, and or proximity to another city or activities, major activity center. The concept of the UDA is that it should reduce demand on transportation. The grant program would be using the on-call consultant assistance from the Commonwealth, and the localities would essentially be competing for this fund, but it would only be available for, or initially available, for those counties, towns, and cities that are required by the law to develop a UDA. And they would be asked, as part of the involvement in this program, to amend the comp plan and to revise zoning and subdivision ordinances to allow for the design intended in the urban development areas. And like other programs, if they were not able to complete that, the grant amount would be returned to the Commonwealth. The next steps, we would provide a resolution for the board in May allocating the funds as just described. And if you agree, we would be procuring consultant services, announcing the assistance programs, and targeting award of the grants by January of 2010.
Questions of Dr. Tischer? Everybody understand this is for the planning grants and the bulk of them to go help deal with and proactively make the urban development areas work? That's not in every county, but in most of the growing counties. Mr. White?
Do I understand that the UDA program, there's only $3 million for the whole state?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, that's correct.
Do we have any feel for how that's going to shake out for those counties that are mandated to, and localities that are mandated to do this?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, we're anticipating something like 60 counties, and we're talking, $50,000 for county, for each county, city, and town that is required by law to do this. And that would work out to about $3 million.
For a Fairfax County or a Chesterfield County, they're going to have adequate resources to do it their own way. The value of these grants, I would say, are for some of the smaller but rapidly growing counties. Culpeper County could take
significant example or benefit of this. Caroline County is the great example. They've done some proactive planning, and these are relatively small grants that have gotten to them to an interesting spot, to the point where they might actually be able to implement some of their planning.
Okay. Ms. Schwartz.
Two thoughts. One, I think this is a fabulous program and a fabulous approach to doing this. I think a lot of the counties, one, don't have either the capacity to do this kind of planning, and frankly, in some cases, don't have the sophistication to know how to find the people to do this kind of planning. So providing not only the money, but providing the access to consultants who you've sort of identified, who have the skill set to do this kind of planning, I think will be very helpful. I suspect you're being a tad unrealistic on the funding amount, but I recognize you have to start somewhere. Just as an example, we've looked at this specifically in Fauquier County because we need to do this. We need to basically go back, fix some of our comp plans for our service districts, rework the zoning ordinances because they don't fit this kind of planning, and we've looked at the cost of outsourcing that to a competent firm, and it's probably somewhere in the vicinity of $500,000 to $750,000 to do that on a countywide basis. That's not to say you couldn't make a good start with less money, but particularly in counties where you have more than one UDA. Look, it's a great start. Hopefully it will work well, and there'll be an opportunity to put more money towards it as it moves on.
Any other questions or comments? There being none, the meeting is adjourned and dinner is...
Pretty good service.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to the conclusion of yesterday's work session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We have a very, very important presentation by the commissioner about the blueprint and service impacts, which are part of the $2.6 billion reduction program underway within the Department of Transportation. The vast bulk of that, as you know, coming out of projects. In addition to that, the Commissioner and the General Assembly budget are premised on the layoff of approximately 1,000 full-time and 450 part-time VDOT employees, closing approximately half of the vehicle maintenance facilities around the state, about a third of the residencies, and very significant service reduction in areas such as mowing, ferry service, rest areas, you name it. Every aspect of our business is shrinking. By way of introduction to the commissioner's presentation, I think it's very important. Historically and for years, when we hit a revenue bump, we have been able to reach into the highway construction program and maybe weather that storm. We took a very significant step when we took approximately $2 billion of highway construction projects out of the program in February. That was on top of the $1 billion back last June when the program was originally adopted. We did that in order to meet the stimulus guidelines that said you have to commit to an existing funding level for those construction projects. If we go below that floor, that maintenance of effort requirement, we will not be able to qualify for additional federal funding, the bonus obligation that happens on an annual basis, and we think potentially very substantially with the stimulus money that is not committed in other states. So what that means, as you listen to the commissioner's presentation, you don't have that easy out. You have the tough choices about service impacts, where we have to balance the remainder of the budget. And we need and intend to express that clearly and forcefully to the general public, to the General Assembly, and to our congressional delegation, who are all part of this this overall puzzle. I know there are citizens here who may want to address the board on some issues under citizens' time.
Just as a reminder, we are completing the work session from yesterday. At the conclusion of this item, we'll immediately begin the business session. And the first item on that agenda will be public participation. So welcome, Commissioner, and thank you for your hard work on these very difficult issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the introduction and very frankly, the excellent overview that you just provided in terms of recapping and setting the scene. As we begin this morning, this morning I'm going to give you a cross-cutting snapshot of a very energetic set of meetings that went on across the Commonwealth throughout the month of March. I want to thank each of the board members who actively participated in those sessions. They were, as you know, I will report, well attended and very exciting as transportation meetings go. As an addition to what the Secretary provided you this morning for this update, I have also placed at everyone's seat this morning, you'll find a sheet that looks like this. This is an excerpt from the budget adopted by the General Assembly and signed by the Governor, which adds a affirming piece to the blueprint that the Secretary has outlined. So the framework of the blueprint is now firmly established as direction for the department, as I interpret this through the language before you. I would encourage the board members to keep this with you at all times, simply because as I give you ongoing reports and updates and present to you decisions to be made, they will be within the context of this language. So that's kind of the beginning point of where I wanted to start this morning. Here's a quick snapshot of what we all participated in over the month of March as we committed on the service leg of the blueprint to have transparency and review in public meeting and hearing format. What you see listed here are the 11 public listening sessions, locations and dates, and the two that are noted, March 17th in Hampton Roads and March 31st in Fredericksburg, we added two additional meetings because of those locations where we have the concentration of the ferry systems. So consequently, because that was a service reduction area or proposal, we wanted to ensure that we had a clear focus on that particular bullet. On the right-hand column, what you see is the statewide results. We had over 1,270 attendees at these 11 meetings. That's not counting you, me, and the department staff. We had over 280 speakers at these sessions. And in this box, you will see the accumulation of the written record that has been submitted, both petitions and letters and emails that have been addressing the areas, and those total over 5,000 in response. We took 26 hours of testimony in those sessions. We had good attendance by the General Assembly. 25 General Assembly members attended, and over 200 local elected officials in some form or their representatives were in attendance at these sessions. By that measure, I think the meetings were an important piece of the input gathering to shape the service reductions that you will be presented with and what modifications we will propose. Now, I wanted to take this slide, and this one is a little different, but I wanted to put in context the services that we had proposed for these hearings so you can see them in the context of the service bundles as they are emerging in the department. This is some work we briefed you on at the February meeting, and you can see highlighted in the black five areas, the five general service areas that are emerging as we start to focus our work from the center line to the edge of the roadway. This is built on what I've shown, what I have in front of me. I thought you'd like to see this. Robbie Procioso showed it to you in February. These are the maintenance manuals in existence today for the department, dating back to 1989. The most recent edition I have is what we have labeled as a best practices manual, asset management best practices, July of 2005. So that is the base work from which this rearrangement of department activities is going on as a part of our restructuring and organizational design. It helps us bring focus to the department and the priorities that you need to set as you work through tight budget times. What I have highlighted in red on this slide are the service areas that, in essence, we took to the comment to the citizens at the public meetings, those five being a portion of our traffic operations called safety service patrols, our roadside services called vegetation control and mowing services, under facility services, our wayside rest areas and waysides, and then I added one because this is a special facility, the ferry services. So that's not covered in our maintenance manuals per se. It was interesting, as we went through the meetings, we did get comments on almost all of these service area reductions. But I was also struck by the comments that we received that looked beyond this round and perhaps anticipated the next round, because we had quite a bit of discussion at several of these meetings about our commitment to emergency response as it's expressed in snow and ice control. So I wanted to take a minute and just reground the board in our current service standards, which are not changing. They have not been proposed to be changed. Otherwise, I would have highlighted them in red on that first slide and consciously held public hearings to say we are going to consciously change our services. These are two excerpts from the book I showed you here, the 2005 Best Practices and the Maintenance Manual going back to 1991. And what this does, and it's a little hard to read, I apologize for that, in the blue sky or on the blue line, is it tells you our predicted levels of service based on snow accumulation. So if you go down that far left-hand column, you see that we, at a 0 to 2 inch snowfall, on priority one roads, you see the descriptor that we have that currently describes our expected performance. We also have priority two roads, priority three roads, and priority four roads. And you can see treatment or expectation may change based on various accumulations of snowfall. Key point. Today, with the workforce I have, we are exceeding these standards on virtually every snowstorm that we address. Today, with the workforce that we have and around which we are building the future VDOT, we are exceeding these standards in virtually every storm. Now, the next question is, what are priority 1, 2, 3, and 4 routes? There is, on your next slide in your handout, you'll see the definition of what are priority 1s, 2s, 3s, and 4s. Now, the nice guy that I am, I added up the mileages for you of what fits, because I figure that's a question of how many miles have we got in priority one routes, how many in priority two, three, and four. Today, we have approximately 3,000 miles in priority one routes. Priority two routes, when you lay that classification system around, is about 16,000 miles. Priority three routes, about 35,700 miles of the system. and priority four is about 2,000 miles of the system. So with this, you get a sense of the practice that we would expect. And one way to look at it would be a guaranteed minimum. But we have been exceeding this guaranteed minimum as we do our work every day. 2 years ago, when we reconsolidated our area headquarters, which are the launch points for all our service at the emergency response level, that was done with this in mind and understanding that we could still achieve these levels of service from those reduced number of facilities. And that is why, as a benchmark in the blueprint, I have continued to remind all audiences, area headquarters will remain at 189 locations across the Commonwealth. We've done that hard work. That is the launch point. So what we are doing now is reassuring that we have staff allocated appropriately to all those locations to ensure that we don't lose these levels of service.
Commissioner, excuse me for the interruption, but so if the question or the assertion is regarding snow and ice management practices, there is no change to current policies or practices, correct?
No, there is not. And if and consistent with this board's direction and my commitment under the blueprint, if I were changing that level of service, I would do it with this board. I would not do it behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that the perception of that is still a challenge because there are legislators that are still saying to the contrary, and there were 400 people at a meeting that I listened to with the commissioner after being told that there was no change, continued for 4 hours to say that you're not going to plow our roads. And so we have a chore in parts of the Commonwealth to convince them that we are going to be there still, in my opinion. I think, I heard him loud and clear before that hearing ever started, but it was just, even after reminding people three or four times in the hearing that that's not true, speaker after speaker continue to come and say the very same thing, encouraged in many cases by legislators who believed otherwise. And so we have a job still, in my opinion, to do something to try to change that perception.
But again, Commissioner, I think if that question is raised, there's a very simple answer. No, there is no change to service levels, policies, or procedures. And I hope everybody understands that and are able to communicate that loudly and clearly in your affected communities, Mr. Sterling.
I think it's understood at least by the members around the table, and I agree the perception may still be out there. No matter what we say, when others are saying something different, that's going to perpetuate. But I think the truth will come out in about a year, once we've gone through a winter, once we've provided the service. I mean, that's what it's truly in this case, actions speak louder than words, and when they see that the service hadn't been reduced, that's when they'll come to know it. While they're still being told by others that it's going to happen, they're going to continue to believe at least a certain level that it's going to happen. It's just going to take some time to get through, and we just have to recognize that and keep reiterating the no, it won't change, but when it truly doesn't change, it's going to take till that time before they're truly convinced, I think.
Mr. Chairman, there's one additional point I want to make sure the board, because we presented on three occasions to you, our actions following February 12th of last year. One of the most brilliant pieces of work done by this department. We are investing money in ensuring that not only do we maintain our levels of service, but we improve the technology available to our people to respond quickly. With a minor investment of $3 million, we have spread a practice throughout the Commonwealth that, in fact, makes it easier for our people to achieve levels of service, anti-icing. We are investing in improving their communication ability between their command bases, themselves, and state police. Those are enhancements that have been called for from the employees in the field and have wondered why they have not been delivered. And so we are, in fact, doing those things as a part of the plan. We have improved training, and we have established a 24/7 duty officer concept in the department, employed for the first time this winter. Those are all additional pieces that should help show our commitment to emergency response. Now, let's, as we then took testimony on actually six areas, I'm going to focus on the services. At the end, I'll brief you quickly on what we're hearing about the one organizational element that we have heard about, which is obviously the residency consolidation. Just as a quick review, here's the services that we talked about. Our interstate maintenance services, known as TAMS contracts. What we told them is this is what we're spending annually under 13 contracts for four different companies to assume the maintenance, routine maintenance and emergency response services on the interstate system. $78 million annually. We are currently in negotiations with the companies to achieve a $10 to $15 million reduction and to maintain the operational standards that we will employ across the rest of the system as documented in our manuals. Those, I cannot report on those negotiations because they are ongoing. We do expect them to be complete by mid-May. But that's an important point, or an important part of the $50 million that we're looking for in this element of the blueprint. It's interesting, in summary, across the 11 meetings, we got no comments on this. I thought it was a big deal. But. Second item that we briefed on, was, or proposed around, was the roadside services. Here's what we told them. Our mowing investments today in contract mowing are about $42 million. Our proposal was to reduce contract spending by $20 million. We also outlined that that would set a base level of mowing which is consistent with what's in this manual. That is three guaranteed mowings a year, but we would end the process of right-of-way to right-of-way mowing as a part of that practice so that right-of-way would be mowed on a rotating basis, and I've got a clarification on that. Citizens understand we need to create the savings. Contract mowing can be reduced, is kind of what we thought we heard from people. Safety is still a concern. We got several questions on site corners and the aesthetic concerns about litter control because litter hides in tall grass.
In terms of bullet three, because that obviously I think would be the most important when you're going into a budget environment. Yes, aesthetic concerns can be, people want it to look nice, but safety is paramount. What are we doing or what is our plan to ensure that that element is not a challenge?
There are two answers to that question. One, the department still has a fleet of mowers that we manage and run internally, several hundred. In addition, the contract value reduction at half still allows the districts the ability to target where they need to use those mowers. A couple of points for consideration, and you asked the right question. We are going to maintain site distances. These standards are built to do that, or the practices are built to do that. And we have not found a nice way to explain how you rotate your mowing full width, but a portion of the right-of-way will be mowed in its entirety every year on a rotating schedule. So you're not going to see 4 years or 3 years and then all of a sudden we're out there mowing everything. It's a rotating system throughout the district that is doing the service. So all it is a performance standard at that point. Second or third area that we brought for consideration was the safety service patrol, and here's what we told them: the annual cost at $10 million, the mileage served, and the zones as they're spotted. Our proposal was to reconfigure service delivery and change service hours and/or coverage our anticipated reduction was in the range of $2 to $5 million. We got, while I get every day some email, and I know all of you do, about that service where someone was helped by a safety service patroller, we got very little comment at the public meetings about this particular aspect of emergency response. And
but isn't that a function? I mean, unless you've used it, you don't think of it. You don't think of it as a problem, or unless something's happened to you. What? I guess this is the next on.
No, you're on target.
I mean, you're not going to respond if it hadn't happened to you. But when it does happen, having a car broken down in the middle of the road can be a problem for everyone.
Mr. Chair, on that same issue, do we have any way to measure the effectiveness? Have you developed some indices that for every safety patrol stop, a certain amount of congestion may have been eliminated, or is this not, you're not able to measure it? Because I feel it's a very effective service, but I noted too that at our hearing nobody came up and said thanks, it's really good, and don't cut it.
It has many interlocking webs that have caused us to create this service and expand it. It does have, in federal review, it does have an element in an air quality strategy, in the sense that nationally there is a belief that it helps clear incidents quickly, which affects air quality, obviously reduces the queue. There is a belief across the country that it does help reduce secondary accidents when there's a crash. My personal opinion is the jury is still out on the long-term effectiveness of this particular tool and where it should be targeted or not targeted. That is why we proposed in our system, and this chart I've given you in your handout, is the state of play as it exists in the Commonwealth today. We have approximately 28 on-staff employees, all in Northern Virginia, who provide and staff these vehicles, and supplemented across the Commonwealth. The remainder of those services are provided through contracts and encompass about 128 staff to provide the service schedules that you see in this table across the department. It also, in that middle column, number of assists by region, interesting statistic, shows you on an annualized basis how many assists are occurring for those safety service patrols. So as we continue analyzing the proposal that we'll bring to you as a result of what we heard at the hearings, this will be the table of reference that we'll use to show you the proposal that we will recommend in the budget. Ferry services was our fourth service that we talked about. Interesting discussion, just to highlight for you very quickly. Ferry service versus a bridge. At Hampton Roads in the Jamestown, Scotland ferry service, they see that as a bridge on Route 31. Either way, it's still, when it gets old and starts to wear out, it's like a bridge. Your boats either sink or your bridge needs to collapse. So we worry about either one. That's the point. We initially proposed a reduction in ferry services at all four sites. I think I've got that table here. Yes, this is the table we used. Reducing, and in the description we called it 16 hours a day. In actuality, it probably revert to the service schedule that we had in 1999, which was about 19 hours a day. And the savings that would result from that service. The Hatton Ferry in the Culpeper District, Culpeper District I think many of you are familiar with it, is only run 2 days a week as it is, and it's really associated with a historic site. And then the Mary Point and Sunnybank ferries were proposed for service reductions and rearrangement, as you see in this page. What we heard, the public reported at the meetings that they were guaranteed 24-hour service in place of a bridge. And that was constant in the comments that we got. We also heard ferry services, for many, their only access to jobs, hospital, and commercial options for the residents south of the James River. We also heard, because it's been not too long ago that we were required by the Coast Guard to introduce security services on the ferries, that the public felt the security service was, I've struggled with words, onerous, I think, is the best term, and Dana will probably
be another.
Is that a fairly
ineffective, useless, some of the other,
expensive, some of those kinds of
unnecessary.
And we also heard very clearly the demand for a new ferry in that service mix, because we are operating old ferries that are in dry dock significant amounts of time. On the Hatton Ferry, we heard no comments, and on the Sunnybank and Mary Point ferries, people understood the need for a possible change in service. They did recognize neither of those ferries operate as their commute routes. They are rather more important for community character and tourism functions than they are for, nobody relies on our four boat ferries to get them back and forth to work in that arena.
In terms of, your previous slide showed a 17% reduction in the cost, the savings of 17%. What would be the, if you really looked at it, the reduction as a percentage in service? 5%, 20%? I mean, how much service are we taking out to save the 17%?
Good question. I can't pull a number for you off the top of my head. We tried to relate it in terms that we felt the customer would understand, which is the hours of service.
You're still hitting the high point, so I would. I guess my assumption is that you still got a 98% or 95% service that you're providing, given the when the demands are.
If you look at the Jamestown Scotsland arena, our data probably tells us the highest usage is between 5 a.m. and 10 p.m. And so the reduced schedule would have been that schedule from 10 to 5 in the morning or something like that. What that causes is a problem in shifts, because many of the staff that live south, people that live south, are critical employees for service industries north. And so consequently, they need an earlier service and a later service, because if you get off at 11, you got a 64-mile trip home, or you can use the ferry to get home. So it really relates down to that kind of discussion.
Mr. Commissioner, was there any discussion at the Scotland Jamestown Ferry meeting about past tolls or future tolls for that service? To me, that used to have a toll on it sometime in the past,
10 years ago.
I'll defer to Mr. Dickens, who was there.
There was a toll on that ferry, and I think it was eliminated approximately 10 years ago.
As a part of the guarantee for 24-hour service and no bridge.
And if I may,
sir,
to respond to Mr. Sterling's comment, the Williamsburg, Busch Gardens, Yorktown, the historic triangle is heavily dependent on tourism. And a lot of the staff people, the employees, come from the Surrey area. And that's that industry is not a 9-to-5 industry. So the time, even the bulk of the ferry services or use is in that till 10 o'clock time frame. But there's also a significant number of people that are out early and come home late. So the 24-hour is a big issue with the folks up there. And I don't want to speak for the people up there, and there were a number of comments about the tolls in the discussion, Mr. McCarthy, and my sense is that the ferry service is so critical to those folks that a toll would not be something that they would object to. However, for a number of years, there has been discussion about a bridge between the Williamsburg area and the Surrey area. and if you look at it, the James River Bridge and the Benjamin Harrison Bridge, which is at Hopewell, and I'm guessing at this, it was probably 50 miles distance between those two, where there's no crossing of the river. So it is indeed a critical part of the transportation mode for those folks. And I would submit to you that it's not all going from Surrey to Williamsburg. There's also folks in the Williamsburg area coming to work at the Surrey Nuclear Power Plant and other employers in that region. And to carry that further, I think it's absolutely critical, and we're talking about less than a $2 million savings here. I think it's absolutely critical for us to find a way to protect the mobility of these people. And going back to the bridge comment, in the discussions about a bridge across that area, at a point in time, and I think the commissioner has verified it, there was a promise, and I don't know if it was written or not, but there was a promise that if you guys quit talking about a bridge, we'll guarantee you the ferry service 24 hours a day and at no cost. And several people remembered that and brought it to our attention at the public hearing. And if I may make one additional comment, there are four ferries that operate in that system. The Pocahontas is the newest one, has essentially 16 years left in its life. The Williamsburg, which is the next youngest in the system, has only 4 years left in its life. The Virginia and the Surrey have already gone beyond the normal expected life expectancy of those vessels. So what we're doing is working here with a situation that needs some desperate attention, and my recommendation would be that we look to provide the 24-hour service to these folks, and also I would recommend that we look at putting another ferry in our capital budget somewhere along the line before we lose one in the river. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Dickens. And just to add, you know, our first responsibility is work and school trips. That's not a major part of the ridership base for all of these ferries, but it certainly is on the Jamestown Ferry. I know the commissioner is also looking at the cost burden of security services, which are quite significant at this location and is an unfunded federal mandate.
Then we come to our last area, service area, that we discussed with the public meetings, rest areas and welcome centers. And just for your review, I put on the list the proposal that we brought forward, or I put on in your handouts the proposal. Today what we told them is today we operate 41 rest areas across the Commonwealth. Our annual operating cost for those 41 is $21 million. We reviewed the criteria by which we reviewed all 41 to make a proposal that we would close 25 rest areas to save $12 million in annual operating expense. What we heard can be classified into three customer groups: regular motorists, you and me, truckers, and the tourism community. Clearly, we heard this is a highly valued service being provided by the Commonwealth, that they provide a respite for handicapped persons and bus passengers, that the public believes there will be a significant increase in crashes and fatalities with rest area closures, that there is a need to have regular spacing to provide adequate rest breaks for drivers, that the public believes that 50% of the parking that exists in these corridors will be lost as a result of this closure, and that we do in fact provide a unique access for handicapped citizens. I've gotten several letters since I've been commissioner, and there are agencies that review various facilities along our freeways that are not handicap accessible. So that is a valid comment. If you go to a commercial gas station or a commercial restaurant, they are not all uniformly handicap accessible, as we have made our facilities handicap accessible. They do provide a strong advertising opportunity for tourism, and tourism has expressed interest in potentially funding part of the operations of these sites. We did hear that comment in several of our meetings. And we heard clear support for this board's direction for commercialization of the rest areas in the Commonwealth, similar to the Maryland, Pennsylvania models that have been grandfathered into the system. Obviously, the most spirited conversations and input that we got on any topic at all 11 meetings. Here's some points of clarification. Our current average spacing of rest areas on the system is about 50 miles. That's very comparable to national system, with the exception of Texas. Texas spacing is about 135 to 140 miles. I think that's because they drive faster. Commercialization, obviously, of rest areas requires a federal law change. We cannot do it administratively. Rest areas generate about $1.1 million in vending revenues for VDOT and $1.1 million for the Department of the Blind and Visually Impaired. So in total, vending machines generate about $2.2 million. By law, $1.1 million goes directly to the Department of Blind and Visually Impaired. We get $1.1 million, and in essence, we turn around and provide that to the tourism department through the Appropriations Act. So we're a pass-through in essence. When you look at the fatality statistics, everyone references the NCHRP study. This is the specific site. It's 324. It was published in 1989. That's where that study attributed that there would be a potential 3.7% increase in accidents or crashes and fatalities as a result of not having rest areas for a certain type of accident, that being run off the road or drowsy driver accidents. So in that report, these are the numbers that were estimated nationally for that particular statistic. I wanted to put that in perspective. Our proposal, and for clarification, our proposal eliminates currently 358 parking spaces from an estimated total from our report of about 6,000 spaces available to the trucking community, which represents about 7% of the total available in all corridors. As a additional statistic, while I gave you a 50-mile spacing on system-wide average, by corridor, it does vary. In the I-64 corridor, it's about 80-mile spacing. In the I-66 corridor, it's about 38 miles spacing. In the I-77 corridor, it's about 39 miles spacing. I-81 is 50 currently. I-85 is about 29 miles spacing. I-95 is about 49 miles spacing. And if you want to know, we got one in Accomack on US 13. And so you throw that in and the spacing is about 71 miles. But that was not in the fleet that we proposed for consideration.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, I'm curious about the truck parking spaces. It seems to suggest, if you turn it around, that 93% of our parking spaces occur in only 38% of our rest areas. How is that possible? Do we have a couple of huge truck parking rest areas or something?
The 6,000 includes commercially available spaces across the Commonwealth. There is a large truck stop industry that exists. If you look at Botetourt on I-81,
several of us.
If you go up 95 at exit 89, there's a large truck stop facility there. So you count all of those in what's available to the industry.
They, Mr. Chairman, they talked at the Richmond hearing quite a lot about this as a safety problem for the trucking industry.
Correct.
It sounded compelling. I don't know if it's so much about it, but I guess I'd like to hear the pros and cons of that before we make up our minds about this one, because they certainly made a pretty compelling argument about trucks piled up on.
Yes, Mr. Chairman,
and so on and so forth.
We did hear good input. We heard concerns about the two-hour rule that exists, yeah, and the ability to use ramps and other areas. We did hear proposals that suggested even if we closed some rest areas, we should keep them open for truck parking, things like that. So those were some of the detailed comments that we're going through right now. Other questions on this? Okay. The last area I wanted to report on, that's the sum of where we are with the services piece. We also took testimony in the on the residency consolidation that we briefed you on in February, reducing from 44 to 29. This is the highlight of what we told them. Again, the two high points, the 189 area headquarters, and the refocus of our residencies from full-service centers to maintenance and operations predominant focus going out. It's interesting. I heard a couple of tidbits that are interesting because across the Commonwealth, we in fact have different practices with respect to land development and coordination and consolidation. A couple of our districts already do all of their land development and plan coordination at their district offices. The residencies will take your mail. The area headquarters will take your mail. So they then process, so the customer still doesn't have to go to the district office to get a plan review. So it is, there are varying practices across the Commonwealth in terms of how this service is provided. And we did hear quite a bit of comment, not so much from the citizen who comes every day to a residency, but from that special community of local professionals and the development community about the loss of service or access at the residency site. I do want to highlight that we heard very, very clearly a distinction between a place and a person. Uniformly across the Commonwealth, I heard not one negative comment about the staff that are at residency headquarters. Uniformly praised for their professionalism, their commitment, and their responsiveness. So I thought that was one of the biggest things I heard about that. The proximity of services, there was an impression that with a residency administrator gone, somehow the emergency response would be compromised. And so, you know, that to me I interpreted as a piece that has an understanding about our business internally to the department as opposed to what people see every day. And then there were also obviously recommendations and thoughts about not closing this one, trading it for a different residency. So we did get input like that from a variety of speakers. Before I go to next steps, I got a couple of quick conclusions overall for you. I think throughout all of these meetings, I heard clear recognition from all levels of government that we got to reduce spending. Everybody recognizes it. And most people started their comments to us that way.
And what was the follow-on question?
The major conclusions I've reached, however, is that it would appear every service we provide is vital to our customers, because no one proposed reducing anything. No one seemed willing to reduce those services. The best you got was neutral, and an understanding that, well, if I got to give up something, maybe mowing is something I can give up. And since January, 11 public meetings, 4 briefings to this board, 5 briefings to the General Assembly, I haven't been offered a single alternative proposal that achieves $50 million reduction in the program I have to deliver next year. And I did not hear any in these 11 meetings. So you will have some difficult choices at the May meeting. That is our next steps, to complete the review of the feedback that we've received. I can tell you they will modify the proposals that we have brought before the board as the first set, and they will affect the final set that we bring for your consideration. And we will analyze the budget impacts of those plan changes so that you will understand what we've had to trade off or where we were able to adjust. And then we will try to finalize those recommendations and have them for your review and adoption at the May meeting. This got a little bit lengthy, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for that, but I think it is an important topic. It has struck a nerve across the Commonwealth, and I think it, and I can tell you on Tuesday night, Dr. Allen and I used this as a teaching mechanism in a public policy course at William & Mary. And it was amazing the reception we got from the students that are pursuing public policy masters.
Mr. Chairman, I guess it's more of a comment. I received communication from one of the a group in the Fredericksburg region who came out in opposition to some of the plan, particularly the rest area. And so I asked them, you know, can you please identify the $12 million a year in road projects you want to eliminate in order to fund this to meet your, you know, what's your alternative? I haven't heard back from them yet either. So in terms of your not hearing alternative proposals, I'm not surprised. I don't seem to get alternative proposals presented to me when they object to what is being proposed. So I guess that's more in the way of a comment that we're going to have some hard choices to make. You have had to make some hard choices in your recommendations. We've got to meet a budget. There's only so much money available.
Chairman, clarification for me, please. The services that we're talking about, not providing the mowing, the rest areas, the ferry service, is there any way that those funds are counted in our match, our federal match, or are they excluded from the federal match in some way as we figure how to maximize the use of federal dollars? I've heard that both ways, and I'm confused as to whether it is or it is not.
I'm going to hazard a guess here while people really know are consulting, but you know, we took a very important step back in 2005 when we put federal dollars into asset maintenance, essentially a paving. That has proven to be very, very difficult to implement, and there is a limit to how much federal money can go into the maintenance and operations budget. Of the things that we're talking about here, I suspect very few, if any, are even eligible for federal assistance. But I would go back to what I talked about earlier. We now have a maintenance of effort on our highway construction program. So even if these services were eligible for federal funding, we would, by doing so, would violate that maintenance of effort commitment that we have made to the federal government as part of the stimulus program.
I don't understand completely what you're saying. I'm curious if they got their heads together.
The answer is always the devil is in detail.
Okay.
And so
some are
currently a part of our federal funding strategy, but we've discounted and worked through all of that as we, for instance, safety service patrols are partially funded with federal aid. So that's all in the mix of the 14% transfer that we've been doing in the maintenance and operations budget.
I fully support the concept that we have to have a budget that meets mandated requirement to be balanced. I fully comprehend the relationship of these services to actual paving and bridges and other relationships. But I continue to hear clearly the general public, and it's not just a group of people that are irresponsible or who only have one cause. This is a broad-based view for the first time that I've heard for a long time that say we don't want these key services eliminated. Now, modified, within reason, I think 30 miles is too short a distance between rest areas in many areas. I think some could possibly be adjusted, but even there, I feel it's so important, and I know the commissioner and others are considering this, how they will appear if you do close them, because you cannot put up a barricade and not spend any money if you close a rest area, or you will leave the absolute opposite impression of what we want in Virginia if you do so. The ferry service for those citizens down in Eastern Shore, I feel a moral commitment to provide those people that service if we made that commitment years ago, which I believe we did. So I'm in favor of working with the commissioner and the staff in every way possible to figure out how we can perhaps modify these services somewhat, but still convince our broader public that we are providing the safety and convenience on our interstate highways and for those people trying to get back and forth across the river, and not have them take an overly negative view of VDOT for $12 million when we're talking about a budget of $3 billion. And I think we will shoot ourselves in the foot on this, I'm convinced of it, if we don't do this right. And we got 30 days to try to get it right, and there's not a one of us can craft the answer to it, and we're going to be dependent on the staff to come back with an answer to us that will help us not shoot ourselves in the foot, balance the budget, and still convince the public that we're trying to do for them the very best we can after they've told us they don't want these services eliminated. And that's a tough one when we don't have financial support coming from the other side, but it is possible to do it, in my opinion, and I hope we'll make every effort to do that.
If I might just make one comment, we don't have $3 billion budget. This is a little bit like the federal budget where the vast bulk of it is tied up in entitlements.
I understand.
And
but
so
they don't probably doesn't see it that way, Mr. Chairman.
I understand, but it's part of our responsibility to educate and not let that perception go unchallenged. There's actually a very narrow sliver of this budget, which is 100% state funds, in which we have to look at mowing, at ferry services, at rest areas, at consolidations, at vehicle maintenance. And just ask yourself the question, okay, if we're talking about, and let's just take the high-profile issue of rest areas, where we spend $21 million a year on rest areas, how many staff does that equate to at VDOT? And we're trying to achieve $10-12 million in well, let's keep it focused on personnel. We're laying off 1,000 full-time existing employees at VDOT. And there isn't a person at this table that's not going to be affected by that. The 450 part-timers are some of the most valuable people we have in this organization. The real test is going to be in that area. Because ultimately, when you're talking services, you're talking people. And so the way to frame the question may be not so much we got a $3 billion budget, but is it rest areas versus another 1,000 employees? And we got to think very long and hard about the nature of these choices and the way that the choices are being cast in the public domain, because it is not an accurate representation to say that we have $3 billion to deal on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, okay, could you or the Commissioner perhaps end my confusion about this, because it's been implied in earlier comments that, for example, well, what road project would you cancel instead of this? And you're saying, no, it seems like you're saying it doesn't have anything to do with that, that that's not fungible. What is the budget that this is coming out of? Is it $339 million or is it $100 million or whatever? What is
it? And that's a fair question. I think we need to do our homework on that and essentially illustrate here are the aspects of the budget that are tied up in the construction program and in that maintenance of effort commitment. Here are certain things that are tied up and again, it looked like the federal budget. The discretionary budget available to Congress is actually a very small slice of the pie, but that's a very good question.
Well, my point essentially being, if it's not drawn from the total six-year plan budget for operations, maintenance, and construction, then what slice are we actually talking about, and what are the limits within which we have to work on that? Because the public doesn't see, I agree with Dr. Davis, they see a billion-dollar budget and say, I can't believe you people are serious about shutting down these rest areas, for example. And so I would like to get to know exactly where we're cutting from and what the alternatives to those cuts in services, if there are alternatives versus projects. I agree with you about the people. In fact, I worry about, even though you said it, I worry about being able to maintain the level of services if you're going to have 1,450 fewer people. I haven't quite put my head around that yet either, but I'm hoping that we have a higher level of service now that we'll actually get down to delivering what we promised when we have a smaller agency to deliver it. But all of that, I think we really need to see spelled out globally in a way that says this is what you're actually able to cut. Here are your choices. Here are your alternatives.
And I think that's an excellent request and one that we, I think we can all do a better job on. Understand how much, and again, I want to say to the commissioner and to Ms. Busher's staff have been asked to be going in completely opposite directions with the stimulus package in one direction and layoffs in another. You want to talk about sending mixed messages to a very dedicated group of employees. And I have to say, again, less as more as an observer and less as a participant, that, again, they have responded with grace and humility and success. But at some point, we're going to reach that breaking point where our assumption that the chief engineer can deliver projects on time, on budget, I mean, we accept that as a given. I know those of you who joined the board back in 2002 remember when that was no longer a given. We may be calling that into question. You can only do so much with so many people. Mr. Coulmay, and then Mr. Martin, and then we'll come over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are difficult decisions. Business learned a long time ago that regardless of their economic situation, that really the quality of service they provide is really the differentiator in the marketplace. So there's a real danger in cutting or limiting the services that we deliver. But there's also something business learned. It had to actually sell the value of that service. So, I mean, you see the commercials. It's like you need a personal financial advisor, not just, you know, trading online or whatever. But I think we have to be mindful of those two things. And in my hearing, there clearly was a statement of the value of these services by various audiences, but there wasn't necessarily our ability to look back at them and tell them what it would really cost. A conversation we had last night casually, I mentioned the truck that has this vehicle pays $1,048 each year in taxes. Well, what we're talking about is changing that sticker to $1,053 in taxes. It's not a big deal. Now you say, well, I have a trucking fleet of X and it would raise this and so, well, you know what? The whole world changes all the time, and I think that's the other thing we have to face here. We're used to thinking of ourselves as apart from that, whether it's a moral obligation or a commitment or a promise or whatever, you know, we're public servants, we're looking at the public business, we want to carry through on those things. But in fact, even if we use a polite term that these are things that are not being broken on a daily basis, let's say they're going to be renegotiated. And I think that's what the board has to look at itself and understand, is we're going to have to renegotiate some of these basic commitments, whether it's services we provide, the quality we provide, and some promises, just like some other things in life, are just going to have to move on. I think we've honored the promise on the ferries, quite frankly. It's not an eternal commitment. It can't be. I mean, for one thing, the equipment's going to fall apart, and that'll be it. So we've got to come up with something better as an alternative to that. And I'd love to add that to the capital budget. But you know what? There isn't a capital budget. There's not a separate set of money that we're not using. So we need to understand this and help people understand this, that if they value certain services, then they need to save what they're willing to pay for them. And I'm not a big free market substitute for government service guy, but in this case, we need to price these things out and let people make their own decisions about them. for a trucking company or an individual, the travel costs and freight costs are part of doing business. It's a calculation they have to make on a daily basis, a monthly basis, an annual basis, whether it's the price of gasoline goes up or the price of the ferry goes up. The price of the ferry is part of the same equation. We can't insulate ourselves from those same types of decisions any longer. So I'd like us to really try to bore in as business people would do, not in a cold, dispassionate, detached fashion, but in fact the opposite. What is the business that we're trying to stay in? What are the services we're trying to provide? And how do we really deliver those in a quality manner so they're not only valued in rhetoric, but they're valued in terms of being paid for? If we don't, we're leading our own public down a false path. And we've been there. I could have used garden path. That would be better, I suppose. We've been there, and we have actually people who do that a lot better than we do. So I don't think we should do that anymore. And that means we have to be honest. We can be responsive. We can be compassionate. We can be engaged. And we can be innovative. But we can't be dishonest. That's the thing we can't do.
Thank you. Mr. Martin.
It was well before the first word was uttered at a public meeting that I had reservations about 40% of the rest area clothing coming out of the middle of I-81. I would submit that let's make 75-mile spacing as opposed to 300-mile spacing on 81. I saw the criteria for selecting, so let's alter that criteria and leave some open part way down so that perhaps you had one-third the way and one-third the way and one-third the way or three-quarters of the way. And so surely trading off the location cannot account for a full $1 million. And if it does, so perhaps you end up saving $49 million instead of $50 million. The way it is presented to us now may be empirically correct. However, this is a case where it is not the right thing to do. Rest areas 300 miles apart barely serve the purpose. And what I see is like the abusive driver fee all over again. We come back and realize that, okay, well, maybe we should have done this a little bit differently and accomplished the same thing. Or maybe this is a case where we leave more open and we save $44 million. Or throw in your ferries and save $40 million instead of $50 million. But in general, in order for me to support the final proposal, we need something other than on both ends of 81 with the rest areas.
Mr. Bowie?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly am not unsympathetic with the difficulty that the commissioner has been faced with. I was asked to address a board of supervisors about these changes, and I suggested to them that if we were mandated, the seven supervisors and myself, to make the cuts that had to be made, we'd come up with eight different plans, none of which would be pleasing to everybody, and probably none pleasing to anybody. The cuts have to be made, and it's difficult. I don't know where else to take them, but for the reasons that were more eloquently stated by Dr. Davis than I could state them, I could not support 30 days from now a program that included closing all of the rest areas on 81 that are proposed to be closed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think most everything has been said. I think it's pretty clear, and I share the views of other board members that have spoken, and somebody said, and I think it's exactly right, that we as a board cannot figure out what the substitute cuts would be. That's something the commissioner and his staff have got to do. But it seems to me the message is clear that the board would like very much to see a substitute for at least part of the closings of the rest areas. And the board would like to see a solution to the Jamestown-Scotland ferry to keep that ferry open. And I have trouble trying to envision 30 days from now supporting a proposal that does not deal with both of those concerns in some fashion.
Ms. Short?
Ms. King?
I'm very sympathetic to many of the comments that have been made in the public hearings, and particularly for the ferry operations. But, you know, for rural Virginia, many of the things that we're talking about here, we have to drive 2.5 hours to get to the rest area. So it's not primary in their concern of developing this budget. And, you know, mowing is already limited to some degree in certain sections of rural Virginia, particularly in secondary roads in those areas, and even on some of the primary routes. The real impact we're seeing as a result of this revenue shortage is in maintenance areas we're not talking about here today. And we were talking about secondary roads for patching, ditching, paving, and simple asset management that we're going away from for a big percentage of the total mileage of our system, which will be in categories that there won't be funds going to this region, these counties and towns to properly maintain and maintenance our roads. So we're going to get away from maintaining roads for a section of Virginia and a big percentage of the total miles of our roadway to some degree is abandoned. I know it's not abandoned from services, emergency services standpoint, but there's just not going to be funding for proper maintenance of the secondary, in some cases primary, in the secondary system of Virginia. And a compounded impact, adverse impact for rural Virginia, is the fact that with no bond money, we're going to see the elimination of the revenue sharing program. So it's a devastation for rural Virginia beyond closing rest areas, beyond closing, eliminating mowing and things like that. It gets down to the simple assets that we have not being properly maintained. If you're not properly maintaining, you're providing some services in those areas, but the asset we use to get to that service is not going to be properly maintained under this budget. And I know it's not a part of the issues we're talking about cutting here, but it's of primary importance to rural Virginia. And it's part of our message that we have to deliver is that we really are short on maintenance funds above and beyond the issues that are prevalent here today. And so, everywhere we go and everything we do, we've got to use Jerry's example. And I do that. And the Jerry's example is that you paid $175 last year to maintain a road because of the gas tax that's out there. And it shocks people when you deliver that. And I've got to do that on numerous occasions. And it's enlightening, and it delivers the message that it's totally inadequate funding to properly maintain the roads of Virginia above and beyond the five issues that the commissioner brings today that we've got to cut. And it's not good for a system.
Ms. Schwartz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I think we do need to acknowledge that you've got a next to impossible job with this blueprint that you're working on. And I want to tell you that this board member would vote for this blueprint today and will vote for it in a month in its current form, or if it's slightly revised. I don't expect you to have to or be able to please me or any other person on this board. And I want you to know that we all thoroughly appreciate the difficulty of the job that you have. Having said that, I just wanted to particularly reiterate the point that Mr. Colomay made, and perhaps we'll talk about it a little more, Mr. Chairman, in our new business when we talk about sort of the, you know, where this board is going policy-wise. I do think we have to always be looking at new ways to reinvent what we do. Reminded of the Federal Express model, where they came out with computerized tracking for package delivery. They were a leader in that. That's now an industry standard. You know, you order something from Sears and you track it on on the computer, but it was a fabulous example of a reinvention model because it both created a better service for the customer and saved them a huge amount of money. I wonder that there aren't examples like that in this business. I'm sure there are, and I think we've got to commit ourselves for looking for them. I'm intrigued by the potential for a privatization model for the rest areas. I recognize that you had to put together this cost-cutting budget in a time frame that frankly didn't permit you to implement that in such a short period of time, but I do think it's something we could look at going forward. Another thing potentially that could be looked at in terms of the rest areas is from a safety perspective, just the ability to pull over and park and take a nap when you're driving and you're tired, I think is an important part of the safety aspect that that the rest areas provide. And I don't know whether there's a way consistent with, you know, safety and security issues within those areas that even if rest areas are closed, the ability to preserve those parking spaces where, you know, a tired motorist or trucker can pull over is something that's feasible, but perhaps something that you could look into, perhaps you already have. And the one last thing I want to mention, and this again goes to the issue of reinvention models and Mr. Colomay's point about expectations. I'll take the heat for being the CDB commissioner who says that the public's expectations on snow removal are unrealistic. I think it's about time we faced up to that. I myself was very much one of these people who, and I'll admit this, truly thought it was a test of character how quickly you could get out the morning of a snowstorm. And I've come to realize that, you know what, it's not a test of character. It's a question of safety. And there are other models, which is whether it's your school systems or whether it's your industries or so forth, you simply accept a level of, you can call it inconvenience or you can call it staying home, smelling the roses and spending some time with your kids. But call it what you will, there's a huge amount of money tied up in the service delivery that you described for snow removal. Along the lines that everything should be on the table, and I recognize that the public doesn't want this to be on the table. That message was quite loud and clear, but I just want to put in the plug for the fact that there's no reason it shouldn't be on the table and that we shouldn't be looking at other opportunities there as we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Dickens?
I'll make a couple of quick comments. I've spoken to the importance of the Jamestown Scotland Ferry. It's a lifeline. It's a roadway. It's a bridge for these folks. It's very important. But I think the bigger issue here is we have a $50 million hole in our budget, and it's a result of the economy, the revenue streams that feed that budget being reduced. But I think in the larger context, those who determine the levels at which those revenue streams are generated need to be a part of this as well. I'm not sure that I haven't heard Mr. McCarthy say that a penny on the gas tax would generate a $50 million source of revenue for the Commonwealth of Virginia, which would go right into what we're talking about here. So, we're talking about issues that we're cutting on the budget, but there's a broader issue here that we need to talk about. And I think we also need to look at it in the framework of what this body needs to be doing in that regard, and also as we are talking with the VTrans and how we change the paradigm under which the Commonwealth manages its transportation network.
Davies, final word.
Well, and I'll make it short, unusually. One of the things that I think came out at least the meetings that I've attended is the concern not only about snow removal, but it's the maintenance of our system and the ability to be able to deliver services, especially in rural roads. The concern about the maintenance of gravel roads, the concern about the lack of funding for pave in place, which some counties like Augusta or Albemarle or Fauquier have used pave in place funding. One of the things that I think was highlighted after our meeting and discussions that we had with people who stood around and talked is that they realize we're looking at very specific, narrow areas for finding funding reduction. Dr. Davis highlighted there really are other areas out there that we may be able to find reductions in, but you can only do so much at one time. I've had several people to ask me, do you have an inventory of real estate? What real estate is not in use? Is there real estate that you can eliminate to generate additional funding? It's been an issue that's been raised periodically. When you go to the development community and you talk to them, they were coming to us when the times were good, wanting to potentially acquire VDOT property or trade property. At least in our area, this was a regular situation. That is not as frequent now, but it is still something that as we look at revenue sources, people are asking, how are we managing those assets? So I think we've gotten a good start, and the commissioner and staff really have done yeoman's work in a very short period of time trying to identify areas of savings to meet our immediate needs. I think it needs to be an ongoing long-term approach that actually helps us to deal with criticism from legislators who are saying, well, you know, VDOT is this big monolith. You have all these assets and all this wealth. You ought to be able to do with it. It lets us say to them, we've evaluated our assets. We're putting them to the best use. And it's an ongoing project. And if there is a need for us through education to shift that burden to them so that they have to respond to citizens that they haven't provided the adequate assets for us to be able to do our job. And I think part of that responsibility really is on us. I think we can help to educate the public on the needs and what we're going through right now.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know before you're finished there, I would like to speak on behalf, I know, of the entire board and the governor. There is not a agency in state government that has taken a more difficult set of issues out to the public. It's one thing to sit in your office and take emails and maybe stand in front of a committee periodically. It's another thing to go out and purposely host 11 public meetings with, frankly, the citizen input, some of it orchestrated, some of it genuine, and some of the, frankly, bad information that was used at those meetings. So I just want to commend you for really being a model in transparency in government and trying to explain very, very difficult issues to the public and to this board. I just think we owe you a real debt of gratitude for that. I would also like to say to the board members, you know, we're a policy board, and so there's a fine line between us establishing policy in a budget and the commissioner's administrative discretion to run the agency, and that's something we have to be very mindful of. I think it is appropriate when the commissioner brings back his plan, this will be embodied in the FY10 operating budget, that we talk about standards that apply not only to contractors but to VDOT provided services. If we're talking about mowing, if it's rest areas, what's the spacing standard? If it's ferry service, you know, what's the standard? And so, what I think is a fair way is for this body to adopt service standards and the funds to reach those, but to ensure and support the commissioner and his administrative discretion to run this agency and to make the day-to-day decisions about how to implement that. And I think that's a successful way to do this. I would ask, Commissioner, again, I think when we come back to the budget and maybe even in the lead-up to the May meeting, if we could impose on your chief financial officer, I know there's no lack of work in that arena, But I think some kind of simple illustration that shows, you know, here's what we need just to simply match federal dollars. And once that's done, there is not a whole lot left over. And when you add to that the maintenance of effort requirement that we have had to certify, that the remainder shrinks even more. And I think with a couple simple graphics, we can illustrate that we have really very, very little room within which to operate. And the alternative, I'm guessing, and could be proven wrong, but I think if you start talking about anything substantially, you are talking about then leaving federal dollars on the table. So every, you know, $1 of state funds that we save, we then lose $4 of federal funds. That's going to be the fundamental dilemma. And again, as we discussed briefly yesterday, and I think we can do a little bit later on today, we no longer have a variety of local and regional and statewide distributions. We have unfortunately arrived at the position where we have a single statewide program, and we're just trying to do the most essential elements of that statewide program. Thank you, Commissioner. All right, any other comments before we conclude the work session? What I'd like to do is come back to the future direction of the board. We could do that under new business in the interest of moving along. I know some folks have to hit the road. So with that, I'd like to